You're listening to an event podcast from the Brookings Institution. For more in-depth discussion with Brookings experts, subscribe to the Brookings Cafeteria Podcast, also on iTunes and on our website at brookings.edu/BCP.
Okay. My name is Kathy Moon. I am the SK Korea Foundation Chair of Korean Studies and Senior Scholar, one of the four in our ever-growing Center for East Asia Policy Studies at Brookings. And we have several scholars from the program who will be part of the conference today, so I'm very grateful for this collective effort. I want to welcome you to Brookings on this gorgeous, beautiful rainy day. We should celebrate it instead of bemoan the fact that it's dripping all over us and that we will have some people who are late, both participants as well as an audience because of the rain. We have one person who is stuck in New York because he can't get a flight out, and we're hoping that he will come in time for the panel on the U.S.-Korea alliance. So we have a little bit of time, so we're going to hope he makes it. We're getting a slightly late start because we also had a little bit of AV, audiovisual problems. I don't know if it's related to weather. I blame everything on weather when my computer doesn't work. So I'll try it with AV. I have been told to let you know that the screen behind us, this multi probably, I don't know how much, but we've had it renovated, this multi whatever it costs screen is having some technical difficulties. So it may flicker, I was told, while people are speaking. So don't worry, nothing will blow up. They're just testing it and it'll all be fine. At any rate, thank you so much for coming, the participants as well as the audience members. To let you know, we have had an overwhelming number of RSVPers, well over 200 for a room that accommodates 140 people, and we will just squeeze them in if they make it in the rain. And it is one of the most diverse audience for a Korea-U.S. seminar that I have ever seen. If you were to read the last names and the institutional affiliations, so diverse. And so it is fulfilling one of my goals here, which is to diversify the interest in Korea studies, as well as those who have something to say that we can learn from, those of us who are in the business of studying Korea. This conference is my, what I would call, maiden conference. You know, ships go on, new ships go on their maiden voyage, and as the new chair of Korea Studies, I thought hard, even before I started my job officially, about what the first substantive conference of my own making would be. And I discussed this with my colleagues, and I decided to focus on both a gap as well as a friendly alliance. I won't go so far as to say marriage. I don't like all these very personal, intimate metaphors we use in politics. But at any rate, both to study both the gap and how to bridge the gap and to bring the communities of scholars and policymakers closer together so that both communities can benefit from each other's work and help each other push the research, policy, analysis agendas in their respective fields. And it is in line with the very foundational purpose of Brookings. The Brookings Institution traces its beginning to 1916, when a group of leading reformers founded the Institute for Government Research. Yeah, they already had one of these abbreviations, IGR, the first private organization devoted to analyzing public policy issues at the national level. And Brookings makes its mark by focusing on academic studies. And there is a reason why Brookings does this. I think you would agree that all of us who care about effective and efficient public service, whether you are in government, civil society organizations, the private sector, the academy, and other fields, would agree that the world needs leaders who can think boldly and creatively and apply independent and objective scientific analysis to understand and resolve many challenges and crises around the world. Today, we celebrate the global scope of Brookings in studying pressing issues and contributing constructive ideas to address those issues. The Korean Peninsula has its share of challenges. Though other parts of the world face what seem like insurmountable afflictions on individuals and communities, obstacles to economic resources, and law and order for basic daily survival. I point this out here because today's conference also focuses on the Koreas in a larger context of regional and global realities. Sometimes specialists of Korea tend to be what Americans call navel gazers. We study our belly buttons. You know, we just look only at Koreas in our very small area. And I think it's well above past time, I would say, for those of us who study Korea to reach out into other issue areas and to link up what's important about the Koreas with other issues in other parts of the world and to learn from the experiences and lessons from other parts of the world and see how they apply to the Koreas. Studying the Koreas and their relations with those outside their borders effectively requires context, historical, cultural, and the contemporary changes that transform both history and culture. Here with us today, we have a truly brilliant diversity of esteemed guests whose expertise ranges from the politics and foreign policy of the Koreas, the United States, Canada, China, Taiwan, Hong Kong, Japan. I tried so hard to get a Russia specialist, but they were not available because of scheduling conflicts. The Middle East, the United Kingdom and Northern Ireland, the Mediterranean island of Cyprus, Turkey, and Germany, a country that offers many lessons for the past, present, and future of the Koreas. I thank all of the guests for the time and commitment they are pouring into today and the preparation for today. And a special thanks to those who traveled a very long distance to be here for a very short time, from South Korea, Singapore, Vancouver, Canada, California. We have a brilliant diversity of speakers in addition to a diversity of expertise and professional experience. And with diversity comes broader perspectives and disagreement, which I highly encourage today. At Brookings, we encourage constructive and creative disagreement. So just remember, constructive and creative. And we invite the audience to join in that spirit. Each roundtable has been tasked with discussion and debate. No formal presentations, no papers, talk, thoughtful talk. To facilitate that process, I sent out questionnaires for each roundtable to consider and invited each member to offer one question of his or her own that would add to the valuable pool of questions. The goal of the conference is to exchange information and interpretations of scholarship and policy in order to benefit mutually both the researcher and practitioner, and of course, you, our larger public. If you take a look at the list of questions that's available to all in the audience as well as the participants, I realized after compiling it together with my research associate, Paul Park, that we have a list of so many research questions to keep people busy for the next 10 years. So anyone looking for a research topic, a dissertation topic, or simply a policy paper, there are plenty of questions. And I think what's more important is that often think tanks and institutions focus on the deliverables. I think what's important is the questions we ask, and that we document the questions we ask, and we have that today embodied in these sheets of paper. I want to thank the Brookings staff at the Center for East Asia Policy Studies, and especially Paul Park, my research associate, for whom this is his first conference that he managed pretty much on his own, and he has done such a meticulous, superb job He's there in the back. If we could give him a hand, I'd appreciate it. Ambassador Gallucci, are you ready? Okay. We are very lucky to have some very prominent guests with us today, starting with Ambassador Robert Gallucci, otherwise known as Bob. Most of you know him and have worked with him, or at least have read about him in various places doing various types of work. Ambassador Gallucci also embodies scholarship, the think tank world, foundation world, and of course, government, through his pioneering work on working on one of the most difficult crisis situations of the 1990s for the United States and for Asia. And he has served as a very long-term dean of Georgetown School of Foreign Service effectively. And that's the key. A lot of people stay around, but they're not always effective. And Dr. Gallucci has been very effective in all of these capacities. I believe you started out teaching at Swarthmore, right? Yes. So he knows the whole gamut of the kinds of backgrounds we are featuring today. So without much delay, further delay, Ambassador Gallucci.
Good morning, everyone, and thank you, Kathy. Thank you for the conference, too. Usually when I have an audience with so many people I know and have enjoyed who worked on Asia, I'm talking about North Korea, and I'm not this morning. This is not about policy prescription. I'm not going to be telling you why I think it's not a terrific idea to capture future policy towards North Korea by asking the question, why would we want to buy this horse again? I never thought that was a very good question, but I shan't go there. Instead, I am, to follow Kathy's direction, to briefly, that's an important word here, talk about what has generally been called the gap between the work of scholars in academia and the work of practitioners very often in government. I want to make three points in this connection. The first is that there is a substantial amount of evidence of a dysfunctional gap. Second, that there are fairly understandable reasons why there should be a gap. And the third is that we should deal with this gap both by trying to find ways to usefully bridge it, but also we should be aware of those times when that gap should be preserved. So, evidence, 3 points. First, academia, for those of you not currently in academia, let me tell you, is still organized into disciplines. We talk a lot about interdisciplinary work on campus in the academy. But walking the walk is a lot harder than just talking the talk. And disciplines, I would say, still rule. Life, however, is not organized in disciplines. So that when we look at what's rewarded in academia, and we say disciplines rule, we mean that the journals are disciplinary journals, by and large, the ones that count most in academia for the reward system in academia, namely who gets promoted and who gets tenured. And the criteria depends very much on disciplinary-based journals. While that's true, for the years that I was in government service, and particularly those years as an assistant secretary of state, I can't actually remember anybody coming into my office and saying in an excited voice, we have a history problem in South Asia. Well, we have a political science problem in Northeast Asia. People in government don't talk that way. As a matter of fact, anybody outside of academia doesn't talk that way. Academia still resists interdisciplinary work. It doesn't reward what practitioners need. It doesn't reward, I would submit to you, what their students need. Little vignette, and I was encouraged by Kathy to use vignettes, so it might not otherwise. So I was new as a dean 18 years ago at Georgetown, and there was a program that was already started called Science, Technology, and International Affairs, and we wanted to make it a major for undergraduates, a true interdisciplinary major. And we hired someone, we had a regular search, we hired someone, tenure track position. We all know what that means here. Wonderful. Person comes in, very experienced, had done some very useful work with the undergraduate program in Science, Technology, and International Affairs at Princeton. All fine. Charged the tenure committee. They go off. 2 weeks later, they're back in my office saying, well, there's a problem here. You know, he hasn't published in biochemistry in a very long time. And I said, well, yes, he hasn't been doing biochemistry for a very long time. He's been working in the area of science policy. That's what we want him to do. This is the School of Foreign Service. That's what we want him to do here. But how do you expect to tenure him? What's his discipline? This is the School of Foreign Service. This isn't even the Political Science Department. This is a school whose identity is wrapped around interdisciplinary work. What's his discipline? So I tell you that was very instructive to me and was useful and guided me for my remaining years, not to fix it, but to just be aware of it, because the dean is not about to fix such a thing. Why is this like this? A second point here. Because IR theory, international relations theory, remains, I think, the dominant field or subfield, Victor can tell us which it is, I'm not sure, in political science and politics. And regional studies, that which many of you in this room commit, regional studies are generally disparaged. For IR theorists, theory building is undercut by geographical limits. However, the policymaker doesn't think in terms of the IR system. He or she in policymaking thinks in terms of, you'll be shocked to hear, countries or regions. This is where stuff happens. It doesn't happen in a system. It happens in Latin America or Brazil. And the IR system isn't something that the government practitioner works with every day or doesn't think about in those terms. Indeed, in my over 20 years of government service, I never once heard a policymaker, a secretary of state, undersecretary of state, say, Jesus, this is tough. Get me an IR theorist. What I have heard is, get me someone who knows the history of this problem. Get me someone who can describe to me the importance of the geography. Get me an economist who knows the dynamics in that region, the economic dynamics. Maybe it's petroleum. Maybe it's something else. Get me someone who's intimately familiar with the domestic politics in that country. Now, I want to know the importance of religion here in a religious conflict. I want to know how culture plays. That's what the policymaker generally asks for. He or she generally thinks of international relations theory as irrelevant to his work. That the word was irrelevant to his work in government. But IR scholars, in my experience in the academy, value research their work that builds systems theory that transcends geography, place, and time, that converts information. And by the way, now you all know we have lots more information than we did as little as 10 years ago, converts information into data that then manipulates that data with actually pretty sophisticated methodologies, all in the service of the production of analytical propositions about big things like war. The IR theorist generally rejects regional politics or economics the same way they would reject regional physics or regional chemistry. What they want to deal with is science of that kind that is not bound by geography, by the world the rest of us live in. So for policymakers, the academics, from their perspective, value and pursue that which they really cannot have, while they disparage what the real world desperately needs. A third point here, which is temporizing a bit, is that there is such a thing, from the policymaker's perspective and from mine looking at this, as good theory, useful theory. Practitioners understand that, I think. They, the practitioners, simplify a complex world with generalizations all the time. These generalizations go to propositions about culture, about religion, about institutions, about personalities, about human nature. But they are often put forth by the policymaker without evidence of any kind. They seem more like prejudices, more ideological often. There's no rigor to them. They are generalizations that are simple and often wrong, and for that, dangerous. So we are in a funny place here, I'm arguing to you. There is a need for generalizations, for theory, for conceptualization. Right? And the folks who can do that are delivering a kind of generalization and theory that isn't useful. So gap is what I'm arguing. Good theory in foreign policy or international relations helps us conceptualize some very complicated situations, helps us conceptualize the flow of history, helps us understand current events. It does build on good and accurate and solid description, but it goes beyond description. It yields explanations of why things happen. And it is self-conscious about identifying the assumptions on which the explanation is based and the important factors or elements, or if you must, the important variables and how these variables are related. There can be good theory. So why is there this gap? I think it's obvious, but I'm not above stating the obvious. Scholars and practitioners live in different worlds. Different worlds that have different missions. For me, the two worlds are the world of the actors and the world of the observers. And each one, the world of the actors, has three castes for me, and the observers have three castes. The actors are these are all practitioners, are policy makers. They are the senior political appointees and the careerists at the senior level. There are the implementers, who very often are diplomats or military people. And then there are the analysts in this world, who are typically in the intelligence community. All three of these groups in the foreign policy world of practitioners have a mission, and it is to shape events for a national purpose, generally. The other world is a world of observers, and this world includes scholars. Their mission is to explain events, but exactly who they're explaining them to differs. Their audiences obviously differ. Scholars are in academia, research analysts are in places like Brookings, and journalists, it seems to me, are out in now a multiple of media venues. But scholars really principally have an audience of other scholars and their students. Research analysts at a place like Brookings serve in a declaratory way, serve practitioners, serve scholars, and serve the public. And journalists, principally, it's not exclusive, obviously, are aimed at the public, serving the public. So when you take us all apart, the world of the actors and observers this way, and see different missions and different audiences, it's no wonder that there are gaps in terms of what people value. So what do we do about that? What makes most sense? Obviously, as Kathy said, there's some of this we need bridging activity in these gaps. And in other areas, we specifically need to preserve the gap. Let me say a little bit more about that. The bridging activity for scholars, I've already given this away, but it's huge for me in the international relations field. I think scholars need to promote and to value regional studies. The world of the actors, the practitioners, as I've said, want this. And what I would say to academia is, if you build it, they will come. They are interested in this. Second, promote and value history. Right now, I put a special emphasis on diplomatic and military history because it is particularly disparaged among historians. History is the basis for good theory. It is the evidence. Great quotes are out there. "Those who cannot remember the past are condemned to repeat it," Santa Anna. If you substitute in that quote the word history for past, you get Churchill's "Those who cannot remember history are condemned to repeat it." And of course, Mark Twain's "History doesn't repeat, but it does rhyme." And my all-time favorite, which is a warning, "Past performance is not a guarantee of future returns," and that comes from my Vanguard investment advisor. Like Mark Twain's cat, who will not sit on a cold stove or a hot stove and therefore learn the wrong lesson, we must, when we look at history, be careful about the wrong lessons and the misuse of history. For a really wonderful treatment of that, for those of you who haven't seen it, go please to Ernie May and Dick Neustadt's Thinking in Time. For practitioners, I would say a lot of things. People in academia, you would ask me very often whether my colleagues in government actually read anything. And I would say, well, it's funny because they've always asked me whether you have ever written anything of use worth reading. So there's a kind of mutual disrespect going on here. But if I were going to pick something out those practitioners to pay particular attention to in scholarship, I would say something you tend to ignore, practitioners, is work that's done on the policy-making process and the impact of process on substance. I mean here, when you go, in fact, to produce an explanation of why the United States of America did something at a particular time, you can operate in any number of levels of analysis. You can cut this lots of different ways. But one of the things in the real world I've found to be depressingly of importance is bureaucratic competition and organizational pathology. If you want more about that, the theoretical bit is, for me, Graham Allison's work of 40 years ago, which still stands up pretty well. Members of both worlds, of all three castes in both, would do well to to cross a bridge between their worlds and then go back to their own world again. This sometimes happens, and there are institutionalized mechanisms for this. The Council on Foreign Relations has run this fellows program for since I was in a graduate student for a long, long time, but others do this well, and people actually learn, individuals, from that experience of spending some time in the other world, and I really mean go back and go forth, come back to where you came from. So the gap needs to be bridged. It also needs to be preserved. This is clear when you think of the gap inside the world of the practitioner, between the practitioners in the intelligence community and the practitioners in the policy-making part, whether they are implementers at one level or more senior, the real policy decision-makers, that there is a literature out there about how the intelligence analyst should perceive him or herself in that world and what the relationship should be to the policymaker. Ideally, I think, this is an oversimplification, that policy analyst within government should be very sensitive to the questions that the policymaker has, but should not be sensitive to what the policymaker wants for answers. I mean, that's the intelligence to please that's often shorthanded as. If you cross over to the gap between the two worlds, as in terms I've been talking, the research analyst, I think, at a place like Brookings again, should be driven by the questions that the actors, those three groups, the three castes of actors, the policy maker, the policy implementer, and the policy analyst, that research analyst at a place like Brookings should be very interested and what it is they want to know. They should be very interested in the course of policy and what the policymaker needs and what they think the policymaker needs. Obviously, again, like the intelligence community, they should not be terribly interested in the answer the policymaker wants, but they should be interested in addressing the issues that they're interested in. The journalist, it seems to me, is in a different world and is in the world of informing the public. And that we have this links to the role of the press in a free society, and I think that's to be preserved. It's not that the press isn't of use or the journalist's work isn't of use to policymakers, but the policymaker is not the principal audience. Now we come to the key part in my closing comments, and that is that I think there is certainly a place in academia for scholars who are completely disinterested in what the policymaker wants to know and what they'd like to hear as an answer to their questions. I think there's a good argument to be made that true scholarship should not be sensitive to this all the time, that there's got to be a place for those who are pushing at the boundaries of theory in the academy, completely uninterested in the current policy problems or what a policymaker wants. There's got to be a place for those scholars. What I'm arguing for here in bridging this gap is that there should be room in the academy for scholars who do want their rigorous scholarship to be of use to the policymaker. In other words, they want to be relevant to the work government should be doing to improve the human condition. There should be a place for students, undergraduates, graduate students, young academics, even before they get tenure, to work in the academy and make a contribution to improving the human condition. My argument here is for tolerance in the academy. It's not for exclusivity. I'm not saying that this should be the only measure. I'm saying that we should have an academy that will tolerate this and reward work, even if it is relevant to improving the human condition. Thank you all very much. Why don't you do this when you've had enough? Any discussion, questions, attacks, whatever? Right there. Show that hand first. Right, just walked by him. There he is. Right.
I'm Larry Nix from CSIS. Ambassador Gallucci, I want to ask you a question going back to some of your comments about history. And I want to use Putin as an example for my question. If you look at his speeches that justify what he has done with Crimea, what he is doing in the eastern Ukraine, his speeches overflow with history. He talks incessantly about Catherine the Great and how she liberated these so-called Novo Rusyo regions from the Turks and settled Russians peacefully in these areas. He never mentions Stalin at all in any of his speeches. But what strikes me, and this is what my question is about, is that in the U.S. government, from the president on down into the State Department, you see no challenge at all to his version of history that he presents when we talk about dealing with him on these particular issues. His view of history is one of the reasons he enjoys 80 percentage plus ratings with the Russian people, who are very steeped in their own version of their history. But in the U.S. government, you seem to have what seems to me to be a kind of dead zone in terms of recognizing the importance of history in these kinds of issues and dealing with it. I think I could apply this to the Middle East, certainly also to the Japan history issue, but how do you have any thoughts from your experience in terms of how do you account for this kind of dead zone within the government with regard to the importance of history?
So I will say briefly to that. I mean, I think the question and observation is a good one. I think there's a stylistic thing going on here, at least, dare I say it, a cultural thing. I think it's far more likely a European, and this is European Putin doing this, for him to do that than it is for Americans to do that. Not that we never do, but so the first thing is I think as a character of a piece of rhetoric, I don't think it's that common. There may be a reference to the founding fathers or something, but we generally, I don't think, proceed in quite the same way as I've seen others in other countries proceed, particularly in Europe. Second, as far as, if you pardon me shorthanding this, letting them get away with that crap, that's a question of what's the most effective way of taking him on this. And I perhaps in a debate over what's accurate and useful use of evidence from history would be a good one. But I want to make sure I had a very well-armed person engaging in that.
Can I just interrupt for 1 minute? If you would please tell us your name, your institution, but also keep your questions very, very brief so many can participate. Thank you.
A question over here, right here.
I'm Li Yang. Thanks for your presentation and pretty cautious warning. And I do think history is very important. And as just like a child to learn and make mistake, and you learn how to improve. The history is the same way back 2 centuries ago. I think we are repeating the same mistake. So I just wonder, as a professional, as an advocate, could you really ask people to make everything they want to analyze to make it useful? A lot of analysis now is really almost useless or misleading because their data sources and the agency that provide those data are wrong, basically not only inaccurate but also wrong. I just wonder if we can really you just kind of provocative to encourage all analysts to not do the same mistake and mislead the public and policymakers.
If I take your meaning, I certainly wouldn't disagree with the proposition that it'd be nice if the data we had was accurate. It'd be nice if the analysis was good and based on good data. The thing I would be most on about is the purposeful misuse of history. I mean, that was what the first questioner, I think, was getting at, and that's what in my reference to the Thinking in Time book by Neustadt and May. You can commit a lot of purposeful errors by the use of history, and I think being careful about, and this happens not even when it happens in government, in my experience, when you look at a case for intervention, for example, in a particular instance, and you say, well, Syria's just like. The thing about it is it's never just like anything. And it's not that there aren't conceptualizations, there aren't generalizations that won't be of help to you. Yes, there will, but the differences in the cases are what have to be teased out. That's one of the points that Neustadt and May make. Right there.
Chris Nelson of the Nelson Report, thanks so much for a really thoughtful, organized presentation. Turned out you did know what you were going to talk about. For the purpose of the discussion, I disagree with your characterization of journalists as writing for the public. And maybe it's just, maybe it's, you know, very self-serving to what I do, because, you know, but if you look at coverage in the Times and the Post and the Wall Street Journal, you know, the major papers of record, yeah, they're informing the public, but they're really writing because they know that's the only thing somebody at the NSA is going to have time to read. The only thing somebody at INR is going to have time to read. They're not going to read the paper. They're not going to have time to come to the conference, but they're going to see, you know, David Sanger on something or something that I've scribbled on something. So it, and it does inform how you write about it. So for that discussion, but especially the history thing, next year is the 70th of the end of World War II, especially the Pacific War. And history is going to play a really important part of that dialogue. And I would argue how journalists choose to write about the debates, especially Abby and the deniers versus Park and the you got to show sincerity. You know, journalism is going to play a big role in that. And it's talking to the public, but it's really talking about decision makers to what you just said. What do American decision makers have to say about history is going to really influence how that comes out.
All right. So, Chris, here's my view, because I disagree with you on this. So I really do believe this, that when I ask myself the question, I was thinking about what I want to say today. I said, okay, what should journalists be doing? I think of what the free press ought to be doing in a democracy. And I think informing the public. I think that's their mission. But don't mistake mistake that observation, that claim I'm making, for the proposition that in government is not a consumer. Look, the very first thing you look at when you get up in the morning, if you're an assistant secretary of state for political and military affairs, that's the one thing I'm sure I know what happens because I did that, is not the intelligence that comes in, the hot intelligence from the community, not the cable traffic from last night. I mean, these are all important, but they're not as important as the newspapers in those days. The first thing you look at is what the press is saying. And with all respect to David Sanger, we love David Sanger, right? But we have a lot of smart people in government too. But the American public isn't reading these people in government. They're reading David Sanger. We care about this so much, more than the intelligence and more than the cable traffic, because the American people are getting their information and what they should think from these people. So the first thing you worry about is what are the American people learning about the world last night, not about the world last night. You need to get that first. And because you've got 12 o'clock follies to deal with, you know, we're going to push somebody out there in front of a podium like this, you know, and answer questions about this, and it's all on the press. So the press is incredibly important to the government, but I would like to think, in my ideal world, the press isn't writing for the government. The press is writing to inform the American people, and the government is very interested in how the American people are getting informed. So that's the second. Yes. Here.
Hugo Kim, previously Ed-in-Chief International Journal of Korean Studies. Now I'm teaching some courses at the grad school. My question is, generally speaking, to create the creating the gap between theorist and practitioner comes from the current educational system. The reason why I'm saying that, usually policymakers in the government are selected from the academic world. They are educated specifically certain area. For example, take an example in economics. Even in economics, there are a lot of areas, international economics and finance and economic theories, a lot of other stuff. So nowadays, specialists are specialized too much in narrow area in political science same. So generally speaking, policymakers too coordinated all of the factors, economics, politics, military, everything. But they don't know much about, even if it consists of consortium with different specialists, but it's very hard. Economists say, we know, we consider political scientists say, we consider the economics in policymaking, but they don't know politics, economics really. If the economist is the boss of the head of the team, he doesn't know, he considers politics, but he doesn't know much about the political science. That's why, I don't know if it's correct or not, but that's my opinion. Thanks.
So let me just, the issue of the interdisciplinary work is on campus is to me always interesting because there is a declaratory policy at most places that favors interdisciplinary work. And what I was saying to you is that my experience, though, is when we got to things that are most valued, the most important stuff, the value is placed on the work that was done in the inference pattern of a particular discipline that with a particular set of journals that are associated with that discipline. And it is a little bizarre. It's not only that the State Department isn't broken into, you know, the departments of the university into disciplines. It's not only that. It's that students, you know, have to go home after their political science class and after their economics class and after their history class and after their sociology class, and they're supposed to put this all together. Right? The faculty don't do that for them. When does this happen? This might happen. I mean, I give only and have for decades now, only oral final examinations for a variety of reasons. But one of them is because I want to see if they've been able to put any stuff together and answer the kinds of questions that you all answer. You know, if someone asks you and you go to your next dinner party, so what the hell is happening with North Korea? Well, it would be good if you knew something about North Korea when you went to answer that question and not just IR theory. I mean, it would be good if you knew something about, yeah, the North is the one on the top. But you bring something to that. And so I have sympathy for the fact that whoever, and we do this, I've had students come to me and say, after we put together this interdisciplinary course in, political economy, and I had the students come to me, they were the seniors in the class, they felt they could do this. And say, you know, it's not interdisciplinary if you have a political scientist and an economist in the class, and one talks for one class and the other talks for the other class. That's not interdisciplinary. And they're right. You know, it requires more work than that. And I do believe that. Right here, then.
Mike Masetic, PBS Online NewsHour. Following up on what you're talking about, more need for studying process. It seems, but based on your experience over the years, is foreign policy making getting more centralized in almost every country, number 10 Downing Street in Britain, but here in the National Security Council? And the National Security Council is headed by a person who was elected and is probably thinking about their reelection. So the extent of the politicization of the foreign policy process, if it gets more centralized in the NSC.
Interesting. I hadn't looked at it that way because I hadn't thought of the NSC as being headed by the president. Yes, I understand the sense in which those who work in the White House may be particularly sensitive to the vulnerabilities, political vulnerabilities of a president. I'm not disagreeing with the proposition. I'm just confessing I hadn't been thinking about that. To me, as an outsider looking in, and that's all I've been for a long time now, this administration, both the first Obama administration and the second, seems to be more centralized than administrations I had known from Clinton back to Ford, I hate to admit. So it seems that it is more centralized. The next step in your proposition, though, was that because it's more centralized, it would reflect domestic political needs more than were it not so centralized. And I'm not sure that's true. It may be, but I have never thought about it that way. And B, off the top of my head, I'd say be careful with that one. It might be, but you can certainly have an NSC that is managed. The classic management of the NSC is the Scowcroft model. If you have different models, and the Scowcroft model was one in which you had a pretty, you had fairly powerful secretaries of the departments of defense and state and the intelligence community, et cetera. But with an NSC that was witting and capable of bringing together these pieces for a coherent decision by the principals and then a recommendation to a president. But that could be politicized too. So I'm not sure I want to go there with the conclusion. But it is more centralized, it seems that way to me, but again, as an outsider. One more question, and I'm looking at it right here.
Henri Baraki from Lehigh University. Bob, as a member of academia, I think I should defend a little bit academia.
Please.
And look, I belong to the school of the tolerant. I mean, I got into government and art, and I believe in influencing government action, etc. But I think your characterization of theory is a little bit unfair, because there is, between the regional studies and the theoretician, is a conceptual thinker, people who can bridge the two. You need the theory in order to be able to bridge and talk about the region, because you don't want just regional specialists. You only know the region as somebody else. As Catherine said earlier, I mean, just navel gazers, because you need to be able to do that. But I would also submit to you that those working in the government, not people like you who came from the outside, are not exactly very ready to understand and to conceptualize. And the more people, especially like we see in this administration, who bring in congressional aides as policymakers, they have no idea of what conceptualization is. They have no idea of how to bridge the gap themselves, and they know the minutiae of the day. And so if there is a gap, it's also that gap. I mean, we also need to raise the level of the people who are also working in the government.
Yeah, I want to – I mean, yes, sure. But I feel quite schizophrenic right in front of you. You know, 13 years as a dean at Georgetown and over 20 years in government service. But I feel at this podium more like defending those in government, because when I went into government for so long, I listened to my former colleagues in academia who had so little respect for the capability and interest of people in government for their work, which they translated into for conceptual thinking. And my point today is that, and it was point number three, it was that there is good theory and there's an audience for it in government, but it's got to be something which they can understand, and it's got to be indeed what they can regard as relevant to what they're doing. And I think insisting that they read the APS APSR, or that they read. I mean, I could get world politics. I can go on these things. They are written for a different audience, and that was my point about audiences. And I will defend the right of the policymaker to say, after he or she reads, you know, a paragraph, this is not for me, right? And you may, or others in academia may say, what is he going to pick up instead? He's going to pick up foreign affairs. Oh, my God. Well, you know, the people writing in foreign affairs are writing to influence people other than scholars, right? That's where they want to have their impact. And they organize their writing this way. Look, you have in this room, I was standing in the back of the room before with Victor. I don't know where he is now. Victor Cha. That's an example of you know, I could pick all kinds. I don't mean to pick on Victor, or I do. But I mean, you know, this is a guy who does really good political science, and he does good policy relevant stuff. And you want to see how it's done, read his stuff. This can be done, and it can be done, and it is done by lots of people. It is, but I don't think we my plea at the end of this talk was for tolerance, that there, and right now I see the intolerance in academia. I see departments that are not willing to acknowledge the value, the worth of pretty rigorous thinking and argument, almost because of its relevance and its accessibility. I have a great quote, and I will not attribute it because I like this person. But his as he told his colleague that he had gotten tenure at one of the top three departments in this country, his one critique after the tenure meeting was that many of us thought your work was too accessible. I rest my case. Thank you all very much.
Thank you very much, Ambassador Gallucci. I think it was a perfect way to start the conference. And just as background, he had written a piece in the Chronicle of Higher Education on just this kind of question, this relationship between international relations, scholarship, and policy. And so that was partly a stimulus for thinking about the conference. We are going to move on to the first roundtable, our opening roundtable. And we have someone from AV who will help with the microphones, et cetera. So.
Great leader.
Waiting for our leader, Kathy Moon. Should we just start? Okay. Good morning. What a fascinating discussion so far. Thank you. And thank you to Kathy Moon and Brookings. My name is Sumi Terry. I used to be with the U.S. government, the other side of the river primarily, and now with Columbia University. I'll be serving as a moderator for the first session today. And today's our first session's discussion is on history and policy. issues, process, and implementation. And I believe our assigned task is to discuss dilemmas and challenges that of the relationship between history and scholarship, and then policymaking and implementation. And to do that, we have a very distinguished panel here today. Most excellent actors and observers, scholars, historians, political scientists, academics, practitioners, Victor, who've done both. And I know they need no introduction, but I'm going to have asked them to introduce themselves anyway. Just a name, title, and affiliation. And if you could also each ask the question that you want to add to our discussion. Okay. Can we start with you?
All right. My name is Charles Armstrong. I'm professor of history. My full title is the Korea Foundation Professor of Korean Studies in the Social Sciences at Columbia University. And I just want to mention that the department in which I reside, the history department, was originally, when it was founded in 1857, called the Department of History and Political Science. So I wanted to hope we could discussion how it is that history and political science became divorced and how we might bring them together, as history as not being just a source of data, but actually itself academic discipline with its own questions and problems that can interact creatively with political science and policymakers. So my question is a very simple one that I think is particularly relevant in our examination and observation of Korea today, which is, what do we learn from 25 years of failed predictions of North Korea's collapse? We've just seen the 25th anniversary of the Berlin Wall falling, which was the beginning of these confident predictions that the end was imminent for North Korea. And have we learned anything, should we learn anything from the fact that these predictions have been wrong? They may be true in the future, but they've been wrong so far. And more generally, I think the policy question is, do we learn something from these speculations about the future, whether they're right or wrong, or are they simply something that we spin out and then forget about?
Victor.
Victor Cha. I'm the D.S. Song KF Professor of Government and International Affairs at Georgetown and Senior Advisor at the Center for Strategic and International Studies here in Washington, D.C. I've been teaching at Georgetown now for 19 years, with the exception of 3 years from 2004 to 2007, where I worked on the National Security Council as Director of Asian Affairs and as the deputy for the U.S. government at the six-party talks. My question was not a question. It's more of a statement. And so I decided, because we had two academics already on the panel, that I would take the identity of someone on the policy side, so that Jonah would not be all by herself. And so I had, I guess I can reframe it as a question. So my questions were, I had two. And the first was, why do academics, and it may not be what's in the paper, so, why do academics consistently underestimate the level of expertise among policymakers? That was the first question. And the second is, why do academics consistently overestimate the view that policy is made in a vacuum, i.e. that policy on a particular issue like North Korea or the alliance is made simply in a vacuum? It's only about Korea.
I'm Taegyun Park from the Seoul National University, and I'm in charge of the Korean Studies program at the Graduate School of International Studies at Seoul National University. I was a former the advisor for the Ministry of Unification, probably 2011 and 12. And I'm a historian, actually, and the my question is, the why is misunderstanding happens between the South Korea and the U.S. in spite of the very long history as alliance, not only in the level of government, but also in the civil society level. So I would like to say something about the
the these days hot issues, in particular about the transfer of the operational control of the South Korean forces from U.S. the force commander to the South Korean government. And if possible, also I'd like to mention about the policy toward North Korea.
Hello, Jonah Odagaki. I am a senior advisor in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Defense for Asian Pacific Affairs. Kathy said that we could ask either a policy or a process question. So since I'm a policymaker, I thought I would ask a policy question. And especially since I think there's so many of you with a lot of historical expertise in the room, I thought this would be interesting, and given that you're going to be looking at unification questions later. So my question is, what happens after unification in terms of what happens after unification when North Koreans can vote to ROC politics, and in particular the U.S. ROC relationship?
Okay, really great questions, but I'm going to add yet more questions to the mix before we get started, because we got a couple more questions from the Brookings. And the questions are first on whether or not, when it comes down to policymaking, domestic politics is a real driver. For example, so regardless of historical legacies, the geopolitical importance of resolving conflicts, so for example with North Korea, does political polarization among political elites and interest groups determine what's possible or not? And the second question is about personalities. So among the various factors that go into policymaking, is the personality or personal relationship between leaders and negotiators a primary driver in policy decisions? So the two additional questions are on domestic politics and personality, personal leadership, and personal relationships. So if I've done my math right, which is not always good, we have about 7 to 8 excellent questions to think about. So let's get started. I would like to kick the discussion off with yet one more question, which is my question, but I have that prerogative as a moderator. So in your assessment, what's the most egregious example of lack of historical understanding by policymakers on both sides of U.S.-Korea relationship? Maybe we'll start with the historian, Charles.
Yes, thank you. Let me go back to the beginning of the U.S. Relationship with Korea after liberation. I think the fundamental problem with the U.S. policymakers had was, of course, a general ignorance of Korean situation, but also, more specifically, a lack of understanding of Koreans' understanding of their history, by which I mean their relationship with the region and their view of the great powers around them. I remember Dean Rusk, who was one of the two men who decided on the 38th parallel, the dividing line between the two zones of occupation in 1945, said years later, they didn't know, nobody in the State War Coordinating Committee knew the history of previous discussions about dividing Korea and the fact that in 1896 the Russians and the Japanese had discussed the possibility of dividing Korea between northern and southern zones of occupation around the 39th parallel. And Rusk said if he had known that, they would have looked for some other solution for the joint occupation of Korea, not dividing into north and south. The Koreans remembered this previous attempt to divide their country, but the Americans did not know that. So, and they also, no, Americans, they had no knowledge of the Taft-Katsura Agreement of 1945, which most Americans still don't know that, but and many Koreans probably don't know anymore, but enough do that there is a kind of view of the outside forces impinging on Korea that I think Americans need to look at. On the other side, I think Koreans in general have a tendency to not look at the history of America's involvement in the world and think that the Americans care so much about Korea, which is not to say that Americans don't care about Korea, but the policy toward Korea is in this global context, which Americans often do not appreciate. There's a great deal of, I think, a very large gap and misunderstanding on both sides.
Well, one example, and it's amusing, but at the same time, it says a lot about how ignorance can become a policy problem, was we once had, when I was in government, we once had some senior level officials from the Korean government visiting, and were holding in the Roosevelt Room. And so I worked for public administration at the so the Roosevelt Room is the Teddy Roosevelt Room. And so there was a big delay, and we were stalling, and the protocol officer who was with us was showing them around the room, and then showed them the Nobel Peace Prize, right, which Teddy Roosevelt got for negotiating the peace, right, between Japan and Russia. And she then went about to explain this whole thing, and I was standing behind her going, no, no, don't talk about this. And of course, he was very, the senior South Korean official was very nice about it, but, and just listened carefully. But then the next day in the Korean press, there was a story that said that the United States didn't have the Nobel Peace Prize, but actually was had a document that celebrated the secret agreement between the United States and Japan with regard to Korea. And that then spread like wildfire throughout the Korean press. So instead of dealing with what we needed to deal with, we spent like the next day trying to beat back that story and explain that it wasn't some secret agreement that had been posted in the White House, but it was simply the Nobel Peace Prize.
Talking about Teddy Roosevelt and Taft Katsura agreement, oftentimes, you know, when our alliance is at a low point, where there's some sort of anti-American sentiment that flares up in South Korea, I feel like our American policymakers have no real understanding. Sometimes we're caught off guard, right? Why is this 2002, like, schoolgirls accident that paved the way with No Moon's election, or the beef protest that goes out of hand? And we don't really understand this origin of it. Like, maybe it starts from the Taft Katsura agreement, where Koreans felt betrayed that because it paved the way for Japanese colonization and the division of the Korean Peninsula and so on. So it's kind of interesting that we don't really have that understanding. But another question then is, where are scholarship or history, because that came up earlier in the morning, is there a time when that's irrelevant to the, or even an obstacle to a policy making? Like where history is irrelevant?
Jonah can answer.
Like history is irrelevant to policymaking, because we're talking about the relevance of history, right? Are there examples of history when it's irrelevant to policymaking, or even poses an obstacle?
Well, I mean, let me start out. I actually forgot to say this earlier, but I'm here in my personal capacity, so my whatever I say today does not reflect any U.S. government views. I wanted to, and actually, this is somewhat going back to your original question. I mean, I think that. And I'm previewing a question that I saw on tap for later. But I do think that this question of I think the question of whether the U.S. Or how the U.S. sort of analyzes its policy, whether or not it bases it on history. Like, for instance, I think one of the questions that's coming up is whether the U.S. prefers Japan over South Korea. I don't know. It's on our tap. I think on tap for us. That's a slight misperception of sort of how Americans approach policy, in the sense that we have this very strong history of being of it not mattering where you come from, but basically what you believe in matters. And I think that. This guides a lot of our policy. We have an affinity for democracies and countries that share our values that extends beyond history. We have a tendency, I think, in general, to focus on sort of those values and sort of our future prosperity over questions of history. So to go back to your slight diversion of the question, when history doesn't matter, I mean, I think that Americans tend to not focus on history as much. And I do think for other cultures, that's, you know, not that it's a little bit of a misunderstanding.
I would say, I mean, I think what Charles said was right. I mean, the United States was ignorant about Korea at the end of the Second World War. But at the same time, I think for U.S. policy and policymakers and strategic planners, and I don't mean to say this to offend a Korea audience, but We know our history when we care about the issue. So if we care about the issue, we know the history. I'm right now finishing a book that's looking at the creation of the U.S. creation of the alliances in Korea, Japan. In fact, this weekend I was going through the Dulles papers. And if you go back and look at John Foster Dulles and his trips to Japan and all that he wrote, I mean, he was really learning about Japan. He was learning from the experiences of Germany. He was really trying to learn the history. So if we care about the issue, we learn about it, right? And right. We know the history and we're sensitive to it. Fortunately, the reality was, whether you're talking about Dulles or Kennan or Truman or Eisenhower, we didn't care about Korea until the North Koreans invaded.
Actually, I found a very interesting letter from the former Ambassador Habib to the Secretary of State in 1972. Actually, the Ambassador Habib, he faced really difficulties in 1972. It's on the one hand, the President Park Chung-hee, he tried to approach to North Korea. But on the other hand, his consolidation of regime was going on. So he sent a letter to the Secretary of State, probably early 1972, is before the Yushin system. And he quoted three very important historical issues in South Korea. And the first one is the 1953 is President Lee Seung-man's release of anti-communist POWs suddenly. It really bothered the joining the armistice agreement. The second is the serious conflict between Park Chung-hee and President Kennedy in 1963. It's about the transfer of the regime from the military junta to civilian government. Last one is 1968 is the security questions. Actually, the 68 have a security crisis between South and North Korea, but at the same time, it's really another serious crisis between the South Korean government and the U.S. Actually, President Johnson, he sent the special envoy Cyrus Vance to persuade Park Chung-hee not to attack the North Korea. It's kind of the retaliation. It's not only the Pueblo incident, but also the North Korean guerrilla infiltrators who attacked the Blue House. So the idea as the historian and the read some kind of documents produced by the Foreign Service, I think that the policymakers, they seem to very seriously consider the historical experience between two countries.
Can I go back to Jonah's comment about this and your question about is U.S. being more favorable to Japan, because I think this is sort of a misperception, or is it a reality? I think it's a misperception that's out there. And then we can sort of talk about Korea, go back to Korea, because you made that comment. So I would like to ask the panelists, is that a misperception? Because I'm thinking it's a misperception, or is that a reality?
But actually, the problem is that...
Koreans believe that,
yeah,
I think.
Yeah, yes, yes, really I think that sometimes it's a misperception, but sometimes not misperception from the Korean side. It's because...
Well, I think there's a difference between the Korean perspective and the U.S. perspective.
There are so many the controversial issues between Korea and the Japan, even nowadays. But the Koreans believe that the U.S. is responsible for that kind of the controversial issues. The first of all, think about is 1951, San Francisco Pact. Actually, the Koreans was not invited in the San Francisco conference. And also in 1965, when the South Korea normalized relationship with Japan, we have so many issues, but some of them is closely connected with the U.S. policy after 1945. The first of all is the Dokdo is island issue. So,
we understand Korean perspective. So I'm asking whether that perception is a right one. The Korean perception, there's a pro-Japan bias from U.S. government's perspective.
Well,
maybe we can hear from
American
side.
Victor's the expert on this, but I just wanted to throw out that it seems that the Japanese are thinking that actually the U.S. is taking the Korean side on certain issues, these particularly over comfort women and so on. So it's not only a Korean perception of
they're getting the short end of the stick.
Right. So I understand. I think we understand the Korean perception.
What I want to say is that actually the reason why Koreans have that kind of idea is that not only the Seungnam government but also Park Chung-hee, they asked the U.S. government to say something to clarify what is true and fact. But at the time, not only the Eisenhower government, but also Johnson administration, they didn't say anything.
So, Victor, maybe you can defend the U.S. government position or explain.
Yes, I'll defend the U.S. government position as it was in 1950. I will say that, in answer to your question, Sue, did the United States prefer Japan over Korea? In 1950, 1945, tonight, absolutely. I mean, it was very clear. If you go back and look at what George Kennan was writing about, it was very clear that Korea and Taiwan, for that matter, were not part of the maritime defense perimeter that the U.S. was creating. So it goes back to so for that reason, we knew nothing about the history of Korea, and we were withdrawing from Korea. But we were trying to learn as much as we could about Japan, about the role of the emperor in society as they try to fashion an occupation policy, all these sorts of things. So you have to ask where do those preferences come from? Why is it that the United States preferred Japan over Korea? And I think even though I plan to be up here to knock IR theory, this is where IR theory is useful. It's largely because our preferences derive from our concern about great powers. Japan was the only great power in Asia. Even though it was a defeated power at the end of World War II, Kennan and Acheson and others knew that would be the only great power in the region for the war. That's why the United States focused on it. Now, on this issue of, a lot of the issues today, and I don't disagree. I think a lot of the historical issues today do derive from peace settlement in San Francisco. Korea wasn't invited to that. But the other thing we have to remember is that, the United States, for centuries prior to the end of World War II, had really a great deal of strategic ambivalence when it came to Asia. Just were not interested in it for missionary activity, for commercial reasons, but no strategic reasons whatsoever. And so, with the end of the Second World War and then with the invasion of North Korea, the United States all of a sudden was put in this position where it decided that it was going to build, so I'm sort of advertising my book now, they decided that they were going to build an empire in Asia, right? And so when you don't know a lot about a region, you decide to build an empire in it, you make mistakes, right? And so there were mistakes that were made in the past, but it's not like we can go back and reopen the San Francisco Peace Treaty.
But I just don't know if he confirmed or disconfirmed.
So let me jump in. So, I think as far as our current position on historical issues, we've made it clear that we want to see some sort of resolution between Japan and Korea that's mutually agreeable for both sides. And I'll jump in with a little bit of analysis on that. I mean, for the U.S., it's greatly to our strategic interests that our two most important allies in the region get along. So I think that's basically I don't think there's a preference, but I will also say anecdotally, having worked on the both, on the Korea desk, which, by the way, just so you know, geographically within the State Department is actually in the same area as the Japan desk. It's all sort of one flow through. There's no discernible preference at all. And certainly now we also have our new desk for Japan Korea is Sung Kim, our former ambassador to Seoul. Perhaps historically, but I think at this point. No preference.
Okay, so let's move to Korea questions, just because we have some time for that. To start with Charles's question, you said about the collapse theory. We've been wrong about 20 years, right?
25 years.
25 years. Can I just add to that a little bit? Because I think who has not been wrong when we're talking about North Korea? So it's not only collapse's school of thought that was wrong. And when we thought Kim Il-sung died, oh, it's going to collapse, or every time we jumped up and down thinking that North Korea was going to collapse for one reason or another. One can argue maybe reformist school of thought was also wrong, because those people like to look at every sign of reforms. North Korea is transforming, really changing. We said that in 2002, we said in 2009. I mean, that school of thought was wrong too. And then there's denuclearization school of thought that if we do this, you know, if we take them off Banco Delta Asia, or if we take them off the state-sponsored list of terrorism, maybe then they would denuclearize. So I'm just saying, I'll just add that it's not only the collapsist school of thought that has been wrong in terms of North Korea for 25 years.
Right. But. Well, I've never been in any of those schools, so I've never been wrong about North Korea. No, I mean, my larger, of course, you know, it's easy to try to call pundits accountable for making wrong predictions, and but that's not really my point. My point is, what kind of traps do we find ourselves in when we spin out the likelihood of certain future scenarios happening and not prepare for others? So, I mean, this is, you know, we talk here about history. I'm a historian, Tegan is a historian, but of course, policy isn't about history. Policy is about the present and the future. So, you know, how do we build upon not just the history of what we are studying, but the history of what we've done in policy, you know, right or wrong, to try to inform our actions in the present and the future? And if I might advertise my book, I've just produced a book that's based on, I think, really the first time to try to synthesize all this information from the former Eastern Bloc about North Korea. You know, from East Germany, Soviet Union, China, and so forth. Do we need, as policymakers, to pay attention to that? Does our new knowledge, and there's all this, you know, everybody says we don't know anything about Korea, North Korea. Actually, we know a lot about North Korea. We know an astonishing amount of information about North Korea, but mostly its history. Does that change our policy toward North Korea if we understand its history better? And this is a question. I'm not a policymaker. Right. It certainly changes my view of North Korea, but does it affect the policy we have toward it?
Does it, Victor?
Well, here's the answer to the question from the policymaker's perspective, which is, okay, then give me five ways it specifically should change our policy, right? And so I think this is where the gap between academia and policy falls, because I think, you know, and I can say this because I'm an academic, so I'm not offending just the academics in the room. I'm offending myself when I say this. But, you know, academics have a tendency to say, here is how complex the problem is, and here is why you're doing it all wrong. Because you're not looking at this, and you're not looking at that. And as a policymaker, you have to sit there and go, okay, tell me based on that specifically what I should be doing differently today. And so, you know, I think this is where there's a big gap, right? One of the biggest transitions for me as an academic going into policy was I was very good at criticizing policy. I was very good at saying what we were missing, you know, what variables we weren't considering, all that. And then, you know, in the first meeting, they said, okay, so what should we do tomorrow? You know, what's the three things that we should be deciding on at the next sub-PCC meeting? And, you know, initially I had no answer because I had been so good at criticizing and explaining how difficult the problem was and what was wrong with the policy, I'd never actually thought about how I'm supposed to operationalize things. And so I think that's a big gap, right? And it's one of the things, you know, that we try to train students to do is to be able to close that gap, to understand the critical thinking on the academic side, but to also be able to operationalize that in specific policy recommendations.
I would agree with that. So I wonder if there's an academic defense for it, because I found it to be true having gone to academia since leaving the government, and I have the students write policy options papers, and it's just and because everybody loves to criticize, right? And you say, you know, Obama administration, the whole, you know, this policy is not working. Except when you ask for specific recommendation, no one really has a recommendation, right? Victor, you've been always saying it's land of lousy options. When you say, okay, what should we do? There is no clear answer to that. I don't know if there's academics there who like to defend academia, but that's the criticism, that you don't have any recommendation. You just only like to criticize. No response.
Yeah.
Can I just throw in that?
Sure.
Or weeks or months.
Right.
Yes.
So we're not just talking, you know,
Yes, that's what I mean.
I don't know if there's a policy that was based on that assumption, though. Yeah.
So I don't think U.S. policy is based on that assumption. In the past, in the present, or in the future. And this is, all right, so this is another thing that I wanted to get off my chest about academics and policy, and that is I said that my question was, why do academics always underestimate the level of expertise that policymakers have? And so on that point, I would say that, you know, they do. They underestimate. I mean, if you look at people on the policy side, the people who are working in the State Department, on the Korea desk, or in the Pentagon, who have been working on Korea for a long time, there's a tremendous amount of expertise there. Or in the IC, right? There's a tremendous amount of expertise there. And it's not that they just know what's going on the policy side. They read stuff outside the policy side. During the week, they're sitting there taking in the cables and the cable traffic and the IC dump every day. But on the weekends, these people go and they read, like, what's in the field, right? They read what's coming out in the journals. They read the latest books. So these people, at least in my interaction with them, they truly have the expertise of scholars, right? And so I think that's a terrible misperception on the part of academics. The second is that academics overestimate how much they know about policy. That basically, you know, policy is not just reading the newspaper and all of a sudden I'm an expert on policy, right? So I can say this, that, and the other thing. Doing policy is hard, right? It's a lot of work. It's daily intake of information, you know. So it's not just saying, well, you know, the strategic patients policy, it's not going anywhere, right? It's because they don't know what to do or what, you know, that sort of. But it's like really understanding the specifics, right? I mean, you know, knowing what a missile reentry heat shield is and why that's important, right? Knowing what rules of origin mean for the FTA and why that's important, right? Knowing what NATO plus three status is. Knowing, like, all these sorts of things is part of the mechanics of policy that matter, right? And that I think academics miss because they just take the top line based on the headline in the New York Times, and they go, yeah, I agree with Sanger. You know, this is, if David's there, sorry, but I agree with Sanger, and therefore, you know, U.S. policy is all messed up. So, so I think, you know, to help close the gap, at least I think academics have to understand that policymakers have much more expertise than you think they do, and to really engage in policy, you have to really dig in to the mechanics. It's not just sort of the top line criticism.
So. Just jump in. So I'm really glad Victor just said all that because I don't have to now say that. But to Charles's question, I mean, I think I actually have a counterexample for you, at least in the past. There was a point at which, and your question was on collapse. There was a point at which Secretary Clinton, I think it was in 2009, said something like, we have to deal with the, in North Korea, we have to deal with a government that exists, not as we would wish it to be. So I do think that there is a lot of thinking about that question of you know, is the policy, you know, what kind of assumptions are we making when we're making these kinds of policies? And it's a constant conversation. I'd also say to Victor's point that, you know, as academics point out to us, North Korea policy is incredibly complex. And for, you know, sort of the functioning policymaking process, there are, you know, at any given time, probably a couple hundred people in the U.S. government working on North Korea policy, and they all have various kinds of expertise, whether it's like the history. I mean, they're maybe intel analysts, and or they, you know, and some of our intel analysts are specialized more in the history, some in the propaganda, some in, you know, the situation as it's evolving, whether they're the policymakers and they may have a political background, so they understand the political situation within the U.S. and or, you know, maybe they have a regional focus, and so they're focused on the political situations in any of the given five-party countries, six-party countries, or whether they, you know, understand the bureaucracy and understand how to get a policy moving. Even having the greatest policy in the world is not going to get you anywhere within the government system unless you understand how to get people to buy into that policy within the system. You know, whether it's, you know, being sort of in the managing role, trying to make all of those various parts work, whether it's if you're, you know, a lot of people come from the outside. We have people from the think tanks working on these issues, come into government. And they have great connections to the think tanks, and so they might, you know, act in sort of a liaison role to the think tanks, bringing more of that thinking in. So I think there's a lot of, it's at least for our system, it's the diversity, and I think this goes back to the original opening keynote address, that really for us to try to capture the complicated nature of the problem.
It's true. I think academics, I think just the coordination process of the policymaking, I don't know if they understand. So even if there is a sort of a solution they'd like to recommend, it's so out of the realm of reality in terms of just, because we didn't get to talk about domestic politics, which was one of the questions that you have to consider the situation now, domestic politics, who's the current leadership, what's going on with Congress, the two parties, and just the coordination process that's involved. We only have a few more minutes before we can turn it into Q&A. Professor Park, would you like to sort of, do you have any comments or?
With regard of the kind of the perception impression,
yes.
That the I think that the one of the reason is that the actually as the voice and as the policy is not clear. I know actually it's not difficult to say something clearly. You know, policy is very, even in the one administration, there's very diverse policies. But from the Korean side and is outside the U.S., actually the people always pay attention to what the U.S. government say and what is their policies, but always feel that it's not clear. And we can very easily experience so many misinterpretation, not only by the mass media, but also even the government officials. And sometimes there's some very kind of a conference in Brookings Institute, and that was reported in the Korean mass media. And the correspondents, they said, it is the Obama administration's policy. It's not the presenter's opinion. So always because of that, the civil society in not only Korea, but also the Japan always, they have some kind of the misunderstanding and misinterpretation. So what I want to say is that I think that there's more clear voice should be needed, in particular about the controversial issues. We say about the North Korea and also the Korea-Japan relation. You know, not only the beginning of the Korea-U.S. relation after 1953, but also these days, so many Koreans, they believe that there's so many pro-Japanese in American government. So that's the reason why the American politicians and leaders, they prefer the Japan. But I think that's really the misunderstanding and misinterpretation. So we need some kind of the clear voice as communication and also.
Well, clear, because it's not clear, you're saying. From U.S. policy perspective. Okay. I think we have a few more minutes. Or should we turn into Q&A? Yeah. You have anything else that you want to get off your chest before we turn into Q&A?
Well, can I go back to the point about the process?
Victor has a lot of stuff that he just needs to release.
The process, I think, is important. And Bob mentioned it in the keynote as well. I think, you know, one thing that is often underestimated is the degree to which process can really, you know, sometimes outcomes don't look rational, and that's because there's a process, right? With anything, there's a process. And sometimes, you know, it may not be the best solution that rises to the top, or more likely, it's that it's greatly watered down, right? Whatever that solution is, it's greatly watered down because there's a bureaucratic process, there are other sorts of things that are their personalities, there are other sorts of things that are going on. And I think in academia, to the extent that we are interested in policy, we often think that, you know, solution A makes the most sense because based on a rational analysis, that should be the right policy. And this is what I meant about policy being made in a vacuum. It's not made in a vacuum. You know, what we do or say on North Korea has implications for what we do or say on Iran. Or what we do or say on North Korea may be constrained by what the undersecretary wants to do on Iran. So there's all sorts of different pieces to policy that don't necessarily make it so simple, you know, that this is, oh, you know, the government's so stupid, that's the obvious outcome, why don't they follow it? You know, if it were that simple, then that would be the course that would be.
As a follow-up to that, I mean, I would say also that there's to your point about sort of message consistency, I would say that there's sort of two parts to that. One is message discipline, right? So is the official U.S. government policy consistent? And I hope we do a good job with that. I don't know. You can tell me how we don't. But the second part is, you know, why does the Congress say something different on North Korea policy versus the executive branch? Or why do think tanks say something different than both? And this is something that's, you know, unique to democracy and extremely strong and a, you know, sort of a robust tradition here in the United States. That there's, you know, these all of these bodies can have different opinions, and that's just sort of, you know, but our Constitution kind of dictates which bodies have precedence in representing us to foreign governments. And then also to Victor's point, I think that the you know, a little bit of this democracy kind of plays out within our institutions as well. So you know, there's a lot of, and because of that, the end product does, as Victor was saying, represents the collection of a lot of different equities. But there is also prioritization to that, obviously the NSS being the NSC being the ultimate arbiter. But within, you know, let's say the State Department, if you have a given policy, the East Asia Bureau, who is charged with our diplomatic relationships, is going to have a view. You know, the Democracy, Human Rights, and Labor Bureau, who is charged with, you know, promoting human rights globally, they're going to have a view. The Nonproliferation Bureau is going to, et cetera. And there is, during the policymaking, a discussion between all of these groups to make a recommendation to the senior people, who then discuss it sort of with, you know, with the Defense Department, with the Treasury, with Commerce. Everyone gets together. And what comes out is something that, you know, is some prioritization and mix of all of those different equities.
Okay, I think we'll open it up for Q&A. We'll take three questions at a time, if you could just state your name and affiliation and succinctly ask your question. One, two, three, we'll take this set and then we'll go.
Hi, how are you? My name's Kristen Kim. I'm a national security reporter and graduate student at Northwestern. I was wondering, with the looming possibility of reunification, many South Koreans, especially in the younger generation, remain ambivalent or rather indifferent about this issue as a whole. So I was wondering the extent to which you think their understanding of history, or sort of the lack thereof, is influencing these attitudes.
Or two other, yes.
It's my comment, not questions. Fundamental issue here is the theorist and the practitioner. Theorists do not have any responsibility. Build theories only for the, based on the generalization of numerous particulars, making theories. So whatever theorists make is not responsible. But policies or practitioners belong to the organization. Organization has objectives. Objectives, I mean the goals and values and missions, objectives and strategies. Based on those fundamentals, policies are formulated. So because of the objectiveness, policies could be different from theories. Of course, they use the theories. Ambassador Carter said that the history is the basis of theories. It's very, very important sentence. But the objective, their mission, objectives, strategies provide the policy. It's basis of the policy. So difference is very clear. Since I'm teaching currently the strategic planning. This is from that theory.
Okay, great. Thank you. Question, please. We have one, and then we'll ask you, because there was not
My name is Li Yang. I think the question is, can we really identify and resolve the problem of the variation between the theories or academic or basic research and the policy making? One thing I can think of is academic focus on theories but forget about the data they get is really from the different sources. The sources give you the wrong data or not the real economic data or real factual data. But there's a hidden agenda also in political side. So if we can say explosion and identify the type of hidden agenda and fix it and make it real, open to the public, this will resolve the things. Thank you.
Name, affiliation, and a short question, please. Right here, this gentleman.
Сергей Костеев, Financial University, Moscow, Russia. Question about Putin. My question is, to what extent American policy toward Korea is influenced by, let's say, Korean lobby? I read an article about Korean business lobbying and this free trade agreement, so there is some Korean business lobbying. So my question is, does Korean lobbying has any influence on
Korean lobby
policy? Yeah, thanks.
Okay, we have three questions. We're going to answer three questions and we'll get back to you. Unification and young people, theory and policymaking, and the Korean lobby impacting. Who wants to?
Unification, right?
Yeah. So, her question was about unification and if North Koreans could vote, right?
Yeah. But Mike, do you say that North Koreans can only vote after unification? What if they can vote before unification?
Right. That's an important, that would be interesting too.
You can talk about that. Do you want to talk about unification and young people?
I want you guys to talk about that, so I'm asking the question.
Yeah, so I can just address the unification and young people. I do think that younger generation in North Korea, in South Korea, that was a slip, South Korea is less interested in unification. And I think that is one of the reasons that is driving the Park Geun-hye government right now into this huge unification is bonanza, unification is a jackpot thing. And it has to do with lack of historical and cultural or any kind of ties. Even when I was growing up, my entire paternal side of the family came from North Korea, and I was indoctrinated into thinking unification is our goal, unification is our dream, and so on. And I think they have less of that kind of ties, and there's just more, you know, there's no concept of Korean War or even the 386 generation or the democratization movement and so on. So I do think there is something to that.
I think that the big impact from the German unification shortly after that, the Korean government really eagerly say about the unification cost. And that is, I think, one thing. And the other thing is that the 1997 financial crisis, after that, the young generation, they really feel the job, the security. So if the South Korea government should pay the unification cost, means that it's the reduced job opportunity. So that's, I think, that the basic the idea and the thinking of the young generation in now South Korea.
Theory and policymaking, I think we discuss a lot about that in Korean lobby.
Well, let me talk. Can I say
unification,
about theory
of course.
And theory
yes.
And policy? So, okay, so now I'm going to use the other side of my brain.
Very schizophrenic today.
There is a lot that is appealing about theory, right? I mean, the notion that you can look at a massive data, a number of cases, and to be able to try to draw out a single causal tendency. You know, this, I think, is intellectually very appealing and very useful. And so the problem I have is I think it's maybe, I mean, Bob and I share the same, which is the lack of tolerance, right? I mean, that, yes, that sort of work is good. It can be useful at times. But the two worlds should be tolerant of one another, should not simply, you know, be disparaging of the other world. And if you're trying to operate in both worlds, it's very difficult. Like, I think it's just as hard, it's even harder, I think, to get published in Foreign Affairs than it is to get published in, you know, a disciplinary journal, right? World Politics, International Organization or something. But as a young academic, I did not even try to publish in Foreign Affairs until I got tenure. Because I knew that it would basically be a waste of time. I mean, it actually works against you.
Yeah.
You tenure track academic, it works against you to publish in policy journals. You know, you write an op-ed for the New York Times, that's probably even harder than getting into Foreign Affairs, which is harder than getting into the disciplinary journals, And it would work against you in a tenure committee, right? Because you're not paying attention to the right stuff, right? So there's that aspect of it. Having said that, I think there are elements of theorizing that are quite useful for policy, especially when they reach conclusions that are counterintuitive to what we normally think. So if there's work out there, large-end statistical analysis, that basically tells us, you know, within a minimal margin of error, that Democratic-controlled Congresses tend to be more protectionist than Republican-controlled Congresses, that's not very interesting to me, because I think for the most part we know that, right? But if, and this is a real example, if you have somebody that can, an academic who can tell you that politicians' votes on free trade agreements are not rewarded or punished in their next election, that is a counterintuitive finding. Right? That is interesting. So that's the basic difference. And the last thing I'll say on theory and policy is that, you know, we've been quite critical of the gap here, but we should acknowledge that probably, I mean, in the United States, you know, we're one of the few societies where we do have academics that revolve into policy, the so-called revolving door, right? People like Bob Gallucci or Tom Christensen or Charlie Kupchan or people like this. You know, we do have people that revolve in and out, and that, I think, is a good and useful thing. I mean, Korea, from I would say about 15 years ago, we see more of that in Korea too, where you have academics that rotate into, you know, Han Sung-ju, who will speak later, and others who rotate into government. We don't see it as much in Japan, for example. We don't see it in China and other countries in Asia. But I think, relatively speaking, the United States, although there is a gap, it may not be as wide as it is.
Can I jump back in on the unification question? Actually, I just had a thought. I also think that, to some degree, that may be partly because of the youth part of that equation, in the sense that I think American kids in general tend to be, the younger you are, the more you're focused on sort of future and less on history. And so I think if you made the argument to an American young person that, you know, you're going to have to make sacrifices in your future because of your history, that would be, I think that'd be pretty tough pill to swallow for a young person too. I think as you get older, you start to think more about history. And that is not to say or to minimize, I think, the thinking of young people. I think I don't know, there's some statistics about sort of when people have their Nobel Prize winning ideas, but mostly they're sort of like in your youth. But is, again, I think, emphasizes the importance of sort of a diversity of opinions and thinking about the whole question. You know, I mean, it's a big decision, so.
I'd like to take just a few more questions, but do you want to give a one-sentence answer to the Korean lobby question that gentleman asked?
I didn't even know there was a Korean lobby.
The third question was about whether Korean lobby is impacting the U.S. policymaking. See, Victor worked at the NSC for some time, but he doesn't even get that, so that shows you the impact of Korean lobby. I think that just kind of answers the question.
There was once a very notorious Korean lobby back in the 70s.
Right,
but,
with the whole Korea gate
and all
during Park Chung-hee.
I was
not aware of it. He's not aware of it. He's like, what? So I think that kind of answers that question. Okay, next set of questions. One, two, gentlemen. You first, yes, please. Name, affiliation, short question, please.
Mike Masetic, PBS Online News Hour. Maybe I'm missing something, or maybe you're compartmentalizing it for a future, for one of the afternoon panels. But in the Korean historical study and imagination, I've heard a lot of triangle of Korea, Japan, U.S. What about China? I've barely heard China mentioned in this panel.
Next question.
Hello, I'm Dennis Halpin from the U.S. Korea Institute. I had a question for Professor Armstrong and the panel about the lack of a collapse over the last 20 years. I'd just like to point out, in 1970, a young Soviet dissident, Amo Rick, wrote a paper called Will the Soviet Union Survive Till 1984? Now, he died in a mysterious car crash in 1980. We got to 1984. You had Andropov in Moscow, a KGB guy like Putin. You had Star Wars, Pershing missile deployment, evil empire. It looked like the Soviet Union wasn't going anywhere. But then you go to 1992, you have Yeltsin on the tank, and bye-bye Soviet Union. So even though in 1970 no one could perceive of the disappearance of the East-West paradigm in their lifetime, it happened. So my question is, okay, predictions of North Korean collapse might be dangerous, but denial of the possibility of a North Korean collapse in our lifetime might be equally dangerous. I mean, is that what you're saying? You're predicting that there would not be a collapse in our lifetime, and that counter planning on collapse scenarios is therefore not necessary?
Thank you.
I'm not saying we should deny the possibility. I think the possibility is there. I'm just saying we should not build a consensus around the expectation that it's going to happen anytime soon. There were a few people who did predict the Soviet Union collapse. Some actually were quite accurate. What is her name? The Hélène de Caus in France. She actually wrote a very perceptive book in the 80s about how the Soviet Union would break up into various ethnic, you know, national constituencies. I'm just a little concerned about kind of a groupthink that might develop around a very specific expectation. And we have to look back and see, you know, how things did not always turn out in the past the way a prediction expected. The one thing I can say about history, this gets back to the unification question as well. The only thing I learned from history is that we can always expect the unexpected. We can do all the planning we want for all the contingencies, but we don't know what's going to happen. And the fact that fewer and fewer young South Koreans want unification does not mean in and of itself that unification isn't going to happen. Unification could happen despite the opposition of a majority of Koreans, and we have to be prepared for that as well. Most Germans did not expect, and many did not want unification at the time that the wall fell, but it happened anyway. So that's all I'm saying. I'm an agnostic, actually, about whether or not North Korea is going to collapse, but I'm certainly not jumping on the bandwagon that's saying it's imminent.
Yes.
So, 2 points, and one of them I'll try to draw together the Mike's question with Dennis's, which is, okay, so if the United States, South Korea, and China start to have trilateral dialogue about potential contingencies on the peninsula, would that be considered policy that is based on the presumption that North Korea will collapse? Is it considered policy that is designed to try to make North Korea collapse? Or is it just good policy in the sense
prudent
that you have to prepare? You have to prepare for all sorts of contingencies. And that's where I think there is a gap between what academics and policymakers think. So, okay.
Do you want to comment on the U.S.-Korea-China
relationship? Yes, about in particular, China issue. Yeah. And before that, I'd like to say about the what you say is, what I want to say is not about the consistency. It's about the principles and clear as decisions or what the U.S. government had the policy towards something. But if not decided, yeah, in that case, I think that the also is not possible to be clear. But one thing is about the now is thought the system, as the missile defense. Actually, these days, in more and more Chinese experts and the scholars, they're giving warning to South Korean government and civil society. You know, the thought, the system in South Korea is kind of cross over the line. And that kind of thing would the really destroy the very good relationship between South Korea and China.
We also
really the controversial issues. So the China is now is very important to think about the U.S.-Korea relations.
We do have a panel later on China, so we're discussing more in depth. We have time for one more question. Yes.
Hi, Mike Billington. I'm with Executive Intelligence Review. since the discussion has sort of turned to unification, reunification, let me extend the question about China to what I think is more fundamental, which is that South Korea has made it very clear that their relationship to China and Russia is absolutely crucial to them, that the only hope for peace in the North is not lecturing them and demanding this and that about their nuclear program and human rights, but providing them an actual stake in development, the long-term development that's already going on around Rajin, and South Korean firms openly working towards a consortium with the North and Russia. And I think that's the question, that U.S. policy is just completely outside of that whole concept, which is what's dominating, and I think correctly, all of Eurasia, with the new Silk Road perspective, great development projects working together, and the U.S. is completely outside of that process, to our detriment.
Sir, did you have one question? I'm looking at you, the one with the tie. Yes.
Lauren Hershey. I'm a semi-retired attorney. I worked in the Justice Department many years ago. Been a student of Asia for about 48 years, so I'm knowledgeable but not an expert. Are there any North Koreans present? That's a question. Number two, is there any track two that goes on between North Korea and South Korea, the U.S., Japan, Russia, or China?
Are you present in the panel? Or
no, I don't think there are North Koreans here. Right? No.
Well, you get the point of the question.
Yes. Track two? I think there is track two.
Sure, yeah. There is track two dialogue that takes place between the United States and North Korea. There are a number of groups that organize it, some in New York, some in California. I would say, again, a common misperception is that the United States and North Korea don't talk to each other. Why don't they just talk to each other? That's why track two is important. But again, that's not the reality is that there's an open channel of communication that takes place through New York between the United States and the North Korean official channel of unification, even though there are no diplomatic relations between the two countries, where they're very easily able to communicate and convey pro forma messages, but also to convey very frank and candid messages. Where track two is useful is when, in periods of time, when that so-called New York channel is cut off for whatever reason. That's when track two dialogue can be useful, because it facilitates contact between officials when they might be instructed otherwise in formal diplomatic channels not to be having contact.
Any other final comment on the? I think that concludes the first panel, and we'll have a coffee break until 11:30.
Okay, folks, we're going to be getting on to the next round table. This is the round table on alliance management, bases, weapons, and command. At first, when I was coming up with the title, it just went on and on. And I decided, this will encapsulate, and people are free to talk about everything under the sun regarding the alliance. I'm Kathy Moon, and I will be serving as moderator and participant. I just want to make a quick informational announcement that Mike Shulman from the Department of State is stuck in New York. He's actually on a plane. He called me from the plane to say he managed to get on the next available flight, but he will not be able to get here in time for now. Therefore, we will include him in one of the afternoon panels, since he's been good enough to prepare, excuse me, and come. And we were very lucky because we have Matt Squarey here, who out of the audience just happens to be also a Korea expert, having served as the director of the Korea office, the Korea desk in the Department of Defense. And he very nicely, kindly, generously offered to step in and serve as another discussant. So we are at full range here, full power. I want to make a couple observations. One is that those of you who have been in government or are in government, would you please avoid abbreviations until you spell out what those abbreviations stand for. For those of us who are not familiar with the USG, USG and ROC abbreviations. And then Andrea and I have just been discussing that when we looked at the list of questions, you know, this is the document that any dissertation student or master's student or anyone who wants to do research can follow and pick up on, that we noticed, and I noticed in the emails that got sent to me before we edited, almost every academic, pure academic, those who have not served in government, and especially the historians, the questions were very long and wordy compared to those in government or having been in government who had, you know, very brief questions. The one exception to the academic pattern was my former professor from Smith College, Stephen Goldstein, who's right here, who gave the shortest question, which was identity and unification. And I scratched my head and I figured, I know him. I'm not going to go back and ask him what he meant. So I added a few words on. But it is quite amazing at the different cultures of even the wording. Okay, so we're going to move on to a discussion on the alliance in its varied facets. And I will just offer you my question since I've given you my name. And my question has to do with my own emphasis in research, especially in the past. The first half of my academic career focused on many of these socio-political issues regarding the U.S. military bases in South Korea. And I'm looking for my many questions sheets here. Oh, thank you. So my questions have to do with the Status of Forces Agreement in particular, because between the U.S. and South Korea, this has been a regular issue that emerges and often is highly politicized, especially by the South Korean public. So how should policymakers address the issues concerning the Status of Forces Agreement, or the abbreviation SOFA? Specifically, the increased complexity of actors in South Korea, especially in alliance politics, the institutionalization of new procedures and protocols over time, do they help reduce some of the politicization and increase better coordination between the U.S. FK, the U.S. Forces Korea, and the South Korean actors? And also the impact on the politicization of U.S. bases, sovereignty, unequal relations, troop conduct, civilian rights. These are all issues that have come up in the U.S.-South Korea alliance, also in the U.S.-Japan alliance and SOFA, the U.S.-Philippines alliance when we had active military bases there. So they're pretty worldwide, these issues get raised. I'll turn to Van to introduce himself and his question.
Yeah, so I'm Van Jackson. I'm a visiting fellow at the Center for New American Security and a Council on Foreign Relations International Affairs fellow. I also adjunct in the School of Foreign Service at Georgetown. And up until a month ago, I had been in the Pentagon the last 5 years in the Office of the Secretary of Defense as the Korea Desk Director and as a strategist and policy advisor focused on Asia. My question. The alliance was born out of a convergence of threat perceptions in 1950, but how does threat perception affect alliance management today? So are there differences in how South Korea and the U.S. see the threat posed by North Korea and threats in the region more broadly? Does the threat perception convergence or divergence within the alliance trickle down to alliance strategy, weapons investments, basing decisions, and the like, or is it all just politics?
Good morning. My name is Andrew Yeo. I'm an associate professor of politics at the Catholic University of America here in Washington, D.C. And as Kathy pointed out, being at this conference on policy, history and policy, it's made me self-aware of how verbose I was in my question. So I'll translate it into a non-academic speak. But my question for us is, does the past success of the U.S.-ROK alliance create biases, making it more difficult for policymakers to see the alliance from a more critical perspective on issues such as the number of troop deployments on the peninsula, on North-South relations, or on questions such as the transfer of operational control.
I'm Matt Squarey. I'm currently unencumbered by affiliation, but as Kathy mentioned, I until just recently was one of the country directors for Korea in the Office of the Secretary of Defense, immediately following Van, actually. In that role, I was fortunate to be exposed to the many ways in which the United States and the Republic of Korea both share in the investments required for the combined defense of the Korean Peninsula, and I worked most closely on negotiating the new special measures agreement and also handling issues related to counter-missile capabilities, particularly missile defense, intelligence surveillance and reconnaissance, and strike capabilities. And in those experiences, I was struck by how significant the investments both sides are making. And the question that I would pose to the panel and to the audience is, how can the two countries share in the investments required for the combined defense? What are the appropriate roles and missions for each country to take up? And what could we be doing differently to share in the investments needed for the combined defense?
Okay, thank you very much. And now they've been very, very, very kind. OSD, Office of the Secretary of Defense, Special Measures Agreement, SMA, any others that we should throw? THAAD.
Terminal High Altitude Area Defense.
Yes, aerial defense. So you'll hear THAAD. I was at a meeting sponsored by one of the think tanks. It was a closed group meeting. I don't remember if Victor was there, but it was Koreans and Americans, and I heard THAAD, SAD, and TAD, and I kept thinking, are these three different acronyms or one? And I realized it was just a matter of pronunciation. Some people wanted to call it THAAD, TAD, or SAD, depending on how their tongue turned. So I thought that was a very interesting linguistic political experience. At any rate, I'd like us to start with Van's question. I think it bridges the history and the policy and brings us from the past, present, to the future. So Van posed a question of the fact that the alliance was born out of convergent threat perceptions in the 50s, and now we have possibly divergence in threat perceptions, and that would depend, I guess, on whom you ask in both countries as well. And does threat perception, convergence, divergence, trickle down to alliance strategy, to weapons investments, and basing agreements? And then, of course, this is a question we could ask at every roundtable, or is it just politics, mostly domestic in both societies? So I open this up to our roundtable. Would Van like to take a jab at your own question?
Yeah, so the first thing I'd say is that this was a brilliant question and highly consequential, very interesting. Obviously I'm kidding, but I'm also serious. So ideally, I'd like to think that threat perception drives the formation of strategy, strategy drives the formation of policy, and then policy drives the everything else. So basing decisions, how much, what does that look like? But we know in the real world it clearly doesn't work that way. And we know domestic politics plays this gigantic role in things like OPCON, in base disagreements, the special measures agreement. But to dismiss everything as politics is not very helpful, right? And so can we at least say when threat perceptions are driving some of these specific decisions? Are there specific decisions that we can identify in the alliance that we can tie back to threat perceptions, either convergence or divergence? And I thought that missile defense historically is an area where the alliance actually has had a disagreement. South Korea has been reluctant to join what it perceives as sort of like a regional missile defense architecture. The U.S. has been promoting something it would describe as a regional missile defense architecture. And the threat imperative from the U.S. side is pretty clear, North Korean ballistic missiles, right? But from the South Korean perspective historically, the threat of ballistic missiles is more aimed at Japan or at the U.S. and not so much at South Korea. And so it makes it the lack of an apparent threat in this respect makes it easier to politicize that issue. And so in the Nomuhyun era, the issue did get politicized. And we're still living with this like missile defense taboo hangover today a little bit. But the threat of missiles is sort of changing a little bit, right? So like, I'm just reading the news now since I'm out of government, but North Korean short-range missiles that used to be able to range Japan, it's not that they can't anymore, but North Korea is changing the angle, right? So it can shoot straight up and down to hit South Korea. So the threat or the perception of the threat is changing, and I'm sensing like a modest shift within South Korean government elites, at least, about the missile defense issue. No drastic sea change, but it kind of seems like South Korea may be more amenable to missile defense something. Maybe not THAAD, maybe, I don't know. But in response to this change in the reality about how we see the threat from North Korea. I don't know if I went on too long.
Matt, can I ask you for a comment on this?
Sure. I think that in terms of threat perceptions, both the United States and South Korea take the threat posed by North Korea very seriously and broadly have similar views of some of the challenges posed by North Korea and have an impressive unity of purpose and effort regarding the threat. But I think that there are divergences in terms of the areas in which the two countries prioritize things to work on. Missile defense is an interesting one that Van mentions. I think that from the U.S. perspective, there's long been a sense that there is no single solution to addressing intensifying North Korean nuclear weapon and ballistic missile threats, and therefore there needs to be investments in a holistic set of capabilities to address the threat, whether it's missile defense or intelligence, surveillance, and reconnaissance, or our strike capabilities, or command and control capabilities that allow us to unify efforts across those capabilities. And I think that in South Korea, there has often been a preference for very visible investments in high-end technology and high-end systems that send a very clear symbolic message to North Korea and to other countries, and I think that there's often been a challenge in the alliance of bridging the U.S. View of kind of spreading out investments across a holistic range of solutions and the South Korean view of focusing on some very prominent symbolic investments. But I think, as Van alluded to, with missile defense, there is an increasing commonality in the way that our countries view the need to invest in these capabilities. You see South Korean leaders often talking about not only the kill chain concept, but also the Korean air and missile defense concept. And I think that there is a I actually think it's very clever branding, the KAMD concept, because it situates this idea of investments in missile defense in a way that is clear that it is an indigenous, independent Korean system. It's not a system that is controlled or directed by the United States. And it also is very clear that this is for the defense of Korea, which I think is very important to Koreans and something that I think Americans can be more sensitive to in advocating for enhanced missile defense, that having better kill chain and KAMD capabilities in South Korea is very important for the defense of Korea.
I find this really interesting because your mention of KAMD, Korean Air Missile Defense, that's another commonly, it comes with the THAAD territory, THAAD, KAMD. There is a political aspect to the KAMD, as you're alluding to, and I think that has to do with history, the history of the U.S.-Korea alliance, and this issue about sovereignty, independence, Korean autonomy, and the lack of equality, perceived equality among many Koreans historically in the relationship, in the alliance relationship. And what's interesting about KAMD is that this is a very, very ambitious project, technologically, militarily, in terms of coordination among various organizations in South Korea, also coordination with the United States. And it is an incredibly costly, very, very costly endeavor. But it is a very symbolic as well as strategic and political project. And so for South Koreans, the KAMD is a very important sign that it is and becoming indeed more independent and autonomous vis-a-vis the alliance, and that it can help lead the alliance and not just follow the U.S. lead. So it is a difficult situation where you need to have for the protection of South Korea from potential North Korean missiles of various kinds, THAAD can be helpful. But then the cost of incorporating THAAD into the Korean air missile defense system or adapting the two together is extremely technologically and militarily, technologically and financially a high-stakes game. So I think it's important to keep that in the historical context because it does have an impact on the public and on the government. I've talked to some military folks in the ROK military who are very proud of the KAMD and who would like to see this succeed and not get it distracted by THAAD.
I'm going to use these military acronyms to teach my one-year-old the alphabet. But I wanted to address Van's question directly about differences in threat perceptions between the North and South. And it's interesting that those on the policy side have addressed threat perceptions largely through material capabilities. But there are other factors, history, ideology, differences in ideas, which shape how threat perceptions are formed. And so if we remember, for South Koreans, North Korea, of course, it's the nuclear program is a direct threat, but you have to remember that for South Koreans, the North Korea issue is more than just military, or it's beyond just the nuclear issue. There's also the issue of reunification. Whereas for South Koreans, for the United States, for the longest period, the North Korea issue was really observed as primarily an issue of nuclear proliferation. So the way South Koreans and the way Americans approach North Korea, I think, diverge. And so that's where you begin to see differences in approaches to the North Korea threat. And more broadly, in terms of the alliance, and this is where I think academic theory may be useful, but there are these power asymmetries between South Korea and the United States. This is just fact, but we know that for Koreans, the U.S. ROK alliance matters much more than for how, I don't mean to denigrate Koreans by stating this, but from the point of view of the Americans, because the United States is considered a great power, the relevance of the U.S. ROK alliance is not going to, it's not going to be at the same level. So when Washington looks at, when Washington looks at the alliance, when they think about threat, it's from a much more global perspective, whereas Koreans, it's really about the peninsula, it's more within the region. Where I do think we're beginning to see convergence is because South Korea has begun to step up and play more of a regional role. And so that's where I think we can begin seeing more of a convergence about threat perceptions for the region. That's obviously good for the US-ROK alliance.
Can I two-finger that?
Sure.
Or whatever? sorry. So my concern actually is that as we look out beyond North Korea, that threat perceptions are going to diverge greatly. So it's way premature, but there's a lot of Korean concern about Japanese militarism, and the U.S., as a matter of policy, supports the normalization process for Japan's military. It has for a long time. On the flip side, South Korea has expressed a lot of concern, especially in the missile defense context, about China. Like fear of being on the wrong side of China, let's say. But as you know, the Department of Defense plans for everything, and there is a lot of preparation in relation to sort of high-end strategic competitors like China. And so depending on what happens in the region, it's completely plausible in an alternative future that we in South Korea are on completely different pages about who's the friend and who's the threat. It's early to make these kinds of calls, and it's going to depend on regional behavior. But found somebody. All right.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm finished. Okay.
I wanted to, first of all, we have Mike Shulman, who valiantly has made it from New York. So thank you very much.
Thank you, and apologies to everyone for it.
No, please. We can't control the weather. We can try to control many things, but not the weather. Take your time and take a few breaths, and in the meantime, we'll fill in. I wanted to get at some of the direct answers to Van's question. I was thinking that in terms of some examples of threat perceptions, we've already had Andrew talk about, yes, there are divergent perceptions, partly because of the proximity, North Korea, South Korea, and the political ties, the emotional, psychological ties, in addition to the military issues, but also that the U.S. being a great power versus South Korea, a middle power and a regional power, of course you have differences in threat perception and strategic capabilities and response and capabilities, partly based on history, but also just based on today's reality. Where history, I think, is important is that more than threat perception divergence or commonality, I think that from a South Korean perspective, U.S. unilateralism is something that is very worrisome and what a colleague of mine at Wellesley calls nervous-making to South Korean policymakers and the South Korean public. And we do have evidence historically for such unilateralism, the Nixon Doctrine and the pullout of two divisions suddenly because of the U.S.'s role in Vietnam and the need to extricate itself financially and in terms of our troops. And that through the South Korean military, government, the public, into a frenzy of fear that the U.S. was abandoning South Korea. And it is a time when actually the U.S. decision brought, the unilateral decision brought the South Korean opposition and ruling parties, the left and the right, together to oppose together the actions the U.S. was taking. The Global Posture Review is a more recent example where many South Koreans felt that it was a relatively unilateral decision on the part of the Bush administration under Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld. And so these incidents, right, historical incidents, I think add to the problem of perception, both in terms of divergence and convergence. It complicates the perception convergence. Michael.
Yes.
Now that you've caught your breath, if you would introduce yourself and give us the question that you'd like to share with the audience in the roundtable and say a few remarks.
First off, happy to be here. I'm Michael Shulman. I cover political military affairs on the Korea desk at the State Department. I've had that assignment for about a year, and I've worked with some great people at State and at DOD, including the gentleman sitting next to me, who I was happy to see when I walked in. So the question that I had prepared was, given what we accomplished as an alliance in 2014, we wrapped up some big things, one of which was the Special Measures Agreement, which covers the ROC contribution to stationing costs of United States Forces Korea. We finished that in January of this past year. And also our new framework for OPCON transfer. We just wrapped that up not too long ago. And I was going to ask the panelists' thoughts on what we think the alliance will accomplish in 2015.
Well, could I ask you what you think we need to accomplish in 2015?
Well, now that we have some those big things out of the way, what I foresee in 2015 is enhancing, continuing our global partnership, which is such a big part of the alliance now. It's reflective of how far the Republic of Korea has come, how far the alliance has come, that we can work together on some really major issues like Iraq, with ISIL, with Afghanistan, counter-piracy. It's quite a long list of things. For the full scope of that, rather than list everything, you can I would refer you to the joint communique of the recent from the recent Security Consultative Meeting, SCM, that's online. We kind of and our joint statement from our 2+2 meeting, which happened the next day. it really illustrates how broad the scope of our alliance is. And that's what I foresee us focusing on, at least in the first half of 2015, working together to address the security challenges, not just in Northeast Asia, but around the world.
Sure. Just to jump in there, I think for 2015, I mean, we have some of the big issues. The OpCon, I think, transfer, there was a lot of questions lingering about that. I don't think it's completely resolved because there's just no firm deadline for it. But thinking about regional and global priorities, one issue that I think the alliance could address is, you know, again, getting back to this discussion with Japan and trying to bring more coordination within among those partners to strengthen our regional partnership. Also, this is something that both Kathy and I have worked on, but in terms of thinking about the alliance ahead, it's a question that I posed about the past success. So we've had this alliance, for 60 years. What's in store for, the next 60 years? And from time to time, we see opposition, we see anti-base protests, we see civil society raising issues about inequalities within the alliance. And I think those are more alliance management issues, but even though these aren't sexy and big issue items, I think those are some things that I think could be addressed further. I know one issue that's on the plate right now is with the environmental cleanup for one of the bases, and this is something that civil society has really latched onto. So I think those things need to be worked over so that you don't have something just pop out in the midst of a crisis like you did in 2002 when you had the two schoolgirls run over in that accident.
I think one way that the U.S. and the Korean governments have been able to improve the management of the alliance along the civil-military relationship line is by making some efforts, I would say relatively modest, and again, relative to, let's say, the U.S.-Japan alliance, and the kind of institutional structures in place in Japan to deal with some of the civil-military relationship problems. So South Korea and the U.S., since the two girls' deaths in 2002 and the huge outpouring of South Koreans' cries and demands and grief over that loss and both governments' handling of that crisis, the USFK has developed mechanisms, measures, programs to help educate the troops about troop conduct within the U.S. within South Korea, and also both governments have improved channels of communication, hotlines and such at different levels of the relationship, the USFK and the South Korean MND, the Ministry of National Defense. And I think those measures will help. When I look at the U.S.-South Korea, USFK relationship with, and compare it to the U.S.-Japan alliance, it's still lacking. The former is still lacking in terms of well-institutionalized procedures. And this partly is the fault of the South Korean government. The South Korean government has never established a structure, an agency or an office that deals with civilian complaints or problems that could be managed so that they don't spill over onto the street and into bigger alliance management territory. In Okinawa, for example, the prefectural government of Okinawa has offices that regularly, daily deal with citizens' complaints, grievances, petitions, issues, so that the prefectural government can work with the commanders in Okinawa, U.S. commanders in Okinawa, and try to manage them before they develop into more critical problems in the larger alliance. I think that's one area where we have room for improvement in the U.S. ROK alliance management territory. I want to get to some of the tough questions. In terms of the discussions, negotiations over OpCon, for the U.S. side, it was very rational to emphasize that we come up with preparation first, preparation and readiness, and then have a date that meets that. But for the South Koreans, it was a bit confusing that no particular date was set. And so there were questions in South Korea, does this mean that this OPCON transfer will actually occur? Is Washington thinking something else? What else might be going on? These are natural questions that might occur when people don't actually are in the know. And so I thought, what are some of our panelists' thoughts on this question?
Well, I can jump in. But first, just Kathy, just to address the points you were raising before, which were very interesting. At not being so familiar with the U.S.-Japan alliance structures, I can't comment to all of those things that you mentioned and make a comparison. But I think it's important when you look at the alliance to note that it is evolving and it learns from its mistakes, which you mentioned. Procedures have been improved and for the civil and military relations and so on. What you saw, what you see 10 years ago is not what you see today. And in large part, that has to do with the evolving nature of the security situation in the region. We evolve, we adapt to it. And most importantly, we collaborate with the Republic of Korea really more than ever before. And we're constantly looking for ways to even increase collaboration. One of the things we worked on this year that I mentioned, the Special Measures Agreement, that includes new consultative mechanisms within that as far as how funding is allocated. That's just one example. We're always looking for ways to improve that. And I think that trajectory will continue going forward. And I also want to note that right now, you know, while we don't take the alliance for granted and we are constantly looking to improve it, it is at an all-time high in popularity. And I think, again, that has to do with the fact that both countries recognize the nature of the threat and that it has to be deterred, and we have to prepare for that threat. And I think that's why the alliance enjoys such strong support, not just from the militaries of both countries, but also at the political level. The dynamic is not quite what it was 10 years ago. You know, we don't have a crystal ball, and I can't see how that's going to continue, many, many years from now. But that's how we see it going for the foreseeable future. And it's worth putting that in perspective. As far as OPCON goes, as you mentioned, we did have a timeline to hand over in December 2015. But the Republic of Korea came to us last year requesting us to reevaluate the timeline and look at a conditions-based framework. And as allies, when our ally comes to us with an idea, we consider it. We talked about it at great length, and we had a lot of discussions, and we came up with a framework that we feel is best for the alliance. And I would want to dispel any idea that the United States is against OPCON transfer. It's not. We see OPCON transfer as the next logical step in the evolution of the alliance. But at the same time, in our bilateral assessment of the security situation, we decided that this framework is a better way to approach it right now, that certain conditions need to be met before we transfer, and the security situation on the peninsula has to be conducive to a transfer. This is agreed on both sides after, again, a lot of discussion, a lot of collaboration. So that's really OPCON in a nutshell.
Van or Andrew, do you have any comments to what's been said, or you want to
add a quick add-on for OPCON? What's funny about OPCON transition with South Korea is that, obviously, in Asia and in Korea in particular, sovereignty is very important, right? It's a very strong norm. It's not immutable. It's not some inviolable principle. And so when sovereignty is very important, until it doesn't support your interests as a nation, and OPCON is an example of that. You know, it's the South Koreans who came to the U.S. and requested a delay in OPCON transition. The U.S. government's been clear about that. This is a request from the ally. So I think it'd be just as likely that the U.S. would be the bad guy in the newspapers if South Korea requested a delay and we said, no way, take OPCON. And so I feel like the U.S. can't win on OPCON, frankly. I think the outcome that we've got now is as good as it gets.
One point on Kathy's question about differing perceptions on there being a date or just being exclusively conditions-based, I think that it's important to consider the factor of credibility here. With this now being the second delay of OPCON transition, both the ROC and the U.S. were both very cognizant of the fact that if you were to set a specific date and the political dynamic on either side changed in a future administration, or if the security situation in North Korea was such that either country was uncomfortable with OPCON transition based on a date certain, then you would face a very real credibility problem of kind of shifting, to use an American football metaphor, shifting the goalposts. So I think that when you're dealing with an adversary as serious as North Korea and the very serious common threats that the U.S. and South Korea face, you have to be very careful about your credibility. And I think that the agreement that Mike discussed is about as good as it gets, like Van said, in terms of preserving alliance credibility.
Very much. I want to throw in a question here that we had not entertained when we were emailing one another, which has to do with the U.S.-Japan defense guidelines. The interim report came out. Many of you have read it. And there is the expectation that both governments, that Prime Minister Abe and President Obama, would sign it by the end of at the end of December or by the end of December of this year. It is not a finished document. The question I have for the panel here is, to what extent and how do you envision, if at all, different impacts from the U.S.-Japan defense guidelines on the U.S.-ROK alliance?
I'll take a first shot at it. I mean, as far as the guidelines go, again, I'm the Korea guy, but for Japan, they were revised really in large part because of, again, the changing security situation, for the same reason why we revisit certain agreements and mechanisms that we have with the U.S. ROC alliance. And, you know, as far as trilateral coordination among the U.S., ROC, and Japan goes, that's very important to us, and it's something we're constantly talking about. We believe that it's really crucial for regional peace and stability. To the extent we can further that, yes, we'd like that to happen, and we hope that with transparency and just explaining that the revised guidelines of what it is, so there's, you know, a trust can be, I guess, you know, trust can be developed by both sides about what it is. That's really the first step, I think, in making sure that's not an obstacle to achieving trilateral cooperation. So we believe good relations between Japan and the ROK are in the best interest of both countries as well as in the region, and we're gonna keep saying that.
I haven't read the new Japan defense guidelines, but yeah, it would be interesting to see if and maybe there is something in the works for a similar one for the U.S.-ROK alliance, but if you were to create it, to have something in there about regional partnerships and be more further defense security cooperation with that in that set of guidelines.
Two just quick points on that issue. One, I think Mike mentioned really the key word here, which is transparency. I think that from my perspective, it would matter a great deal to South Korea to continue to see open dialogue and transparency on what the defense guidelines review means for South Korea. And so I haven't been in government for a few months, but I know that there is communication between the U.S., ROC, and Japan trilaterally on these issues. I think we should encourage bilateral dialogue between Japan and South Korea on how Japanese evolving views of their own foreign policy and defense policy affects South Korea. I think that's all very good, and transparency and dialogue is very important. A second point I would make just on trilateral cooperation. Obviously, it's very important to the United States that Japan, South Korea, and the United States have trilateral communication, that there is robust information sharing between the countries. But a point that I would like to emphasize is that this is not only important for the defense of the United States or for the defense of Japan or for our regional security objectives. It's actually very important for the defense of South Korea. Japan plays a critical role in any contingency on the Korean Peninsula. United Nations Command Rear would operate based out of Japan. Similarly, for any nuclear or ballistic missile threats affecting the United States or any of its allies, robust trilateral information sharing among these three countries is very important for enhancing our readiness. And so I think it's important to note that trilateral cooperation is important for the United States, and it's important for the United States' defense, but it's also important for the defense of South Korea.
Thank you very much. I think we will close up our portion here and open it up for Q&A to discuss further. I'm going to take a question from the back there. I'll take three. There are two, and then Dr. Son.
Hi, my name is Christina Kim. I'm from Georgetown University, graduate student. My question is related to missile defense and the divergence of threat perception. So like Dr. Jackson mentioned, South Korea is more interested in the terminal defense phase because of the short-range ballistic missile system, but that would signify that since it's a mid-course missile defense system, that it would be defensed against U.S. And Japan, the North Korean ballistic ICBMs targeted towards U.S. and Japan. So my question is, the consequence of not joining the U.S. integrated ballistic missile defense, does that outweigh the benefits of South Korea joining this integrated missile defense? Thank you.
In June, currently CIP visiting fellow Brookings. My question is about the credibility of U.S. security commitment to South Korea and other Asian partners. Recently, many American watchers in the region in Asia is closely looking at what happened to Washington D.C. And worrisome trend is obviously the defense spending cut and the polarization in American politics, and how the Congress is effectively passing the budget for defense budget in on time. So the increasing number of the pundits and secret analysts in the Singapore, Tokyo, Seoul, Taipei, not to mention Beijing, as start to discuss the possibility of the collapse of strong U.S.-centered security architecture, and recognize the need to come up with Plan B. Encourage do not place all the eggs in one basket. So given that this trend, how do Washington, what can Washington do and ensure the partners about the reliability of U.S. The security provision in the given the domestic policy?
Thank you. We're recording all this, so for eternity, posterity.
No introduction.
SICE and also at Georgetown starting in the spring. The point about the evolving alliance is a good one, but what bugs me whenever this discussion of the alliance comes up is that nobody refers to history. And there was an edited volume by Bruce Cummings many, many years ago, which had a chapter in it about something called Operation Eveready, which was a U.S. military plan to overthrow, to stage a coup d'etat against Syngman Rhee. So rather than doing that, which was regarded as a high-risk option, we decided to go with an alliance. And look how far we've come. So that point is certainly well taken. But no one ever mentions the origins. They talk about the duration, 60 years. My question is this. What happens to extended deterrence when North Korea develops the capability to hit the United States with nuclear-tipped missiles? And that day is rapidly coming because we're not doing anything about it. We're kicking the can down the road. I'd be very curious to get any reaction from the panel on that one.
Okay, thank you very much. These are tough questions. I think we should start with the last one.
Great question.
Yeah, let's start with that one. Go ahead, Dan.
So in the alliance, in all these many consultation mechanisms that we have, high-level meetings among policy officials, both sides always focus on the next big meeting, the next deliverable, the next crisis, how do we get out of the current crisis. There's very little in the way of institutional capacity to deal with long-term planning, long-term strategic issues. This is actually something that's missing from the alliance as compared to Japan and Australia and the UK. And as a result, we have little like tolerance for these bigger, longer-term questions that get worse over time. So it's like the alliance doesn't think time is a variable that matters almost. And so North Korea's missile program and its nuclear program is proceeding apace. They're on track to have a nuclear triad, which would be like a secure second strike capability. In 2010, North Korea engages in small-scale violence against South Korea. U.S. policymakers were panicked and frenzied about the possibility of escalation with a nascent nuclear North Korea. What happens when North Korea's got a nuclear triad and a secure second strike capability, when it's got a robust ability to attack with nuclear weapons? Is that not checkmate? Like, what U.S. policymaker is going to have the risk propensity to engage in, you know, Cuban Missile Crisis resolve, standing firm, right? Our future circumstances, our future policy options are going to be vastly constrained by our allowing this issue to continue to evolve the way it has. John's totally right. So this is a huge strategic problem because it's getting worse and it's narrowing options for future policymakers because we're not willing to resolve it today. I don't have a solution for how you do that, but the time is making this problem worse, and we could be put on the horns of a dilemma in the future. So I'm being critical without offering a solution.
Without getting too deep into deterrence, extended deterrence theory, I'll just add, though, that it is on our radar for both of our countries, extended deterrence. It's a big part of our dialogues, of our defense dialogues that we have twice a year. And just last year, we endorsed, Secretary of Defense and Minister of Defense from both countries endorsed a tailored deterrence strategy specifically to basically craft our extended deterrence approach, you know, for the foreseeable future. And I'll also note, as many of you may know, that the U.S., the extended deterrence that we provide, are committed to provide to the Republic of Korea also includes the U.S. nuclear umbrella. It's a full range of military capabilities. Nuclear umbrella, conventional strike, missile defense capabilities. We reaffirmed that two SEMs ago. But obviously it's an extremely difficult situation, the North Korean threat and their evolving capabilities. But we do have mechanisms to address it and discuss it and find solutions.
I'd like us to move on to some of the other questions, and we can always revisit some of these, and I welcome the audience to have your rebuttals or whatever ready. There was a question about – go ahead, Andrew.
I was going to respond to Dr. Sohn's question about the regional architecture and U.S. commitment. It was funny because yesterday evening I was having in our dinner discussion another participant was – we were talking about the future presence of the U.S. in Asia, and that person who won't be named thought that it'll take a while, but we may eventually be out the door. And my research has been focused on, you know, from the origins of the bilateral security architecture to, you know, multilateralism today. Looking at this from a long-term perspective, and from my reading of it, I do think that the U.S. is committed to this region. And if you look at U.S. policy towards Asia even a decade ago, it was primarily about bilateral alliances, but there was But starting from about 5, 6, 7 years ago, we've seen the U.S. begin shifting towards, you know, different multilateral. They've been thinking more about multilateralism. So if you take, for example, the East Asia Summit or, you know, the ARF, we now have, you know, we take those multilateral venues much more seriously than we did in the past. If you look at new partnerships that we're building in Southeast Asia or even the strengthening of U.S.-ASEAN relations from 2009 forward, there's a lot of signs that indicate that we are committed to this region. I don't know how that translates, though, into, you know, boots on the ground for that part of the world, but we do have to think beyond just bilateral alliances. I think that's the core of our security framework for the region, our meaning the United States, which the U.S.-South Korea alliance plays an integral part. But we've seen the building of these other institutional mechanisms in place. So it's a combination of this bilaterals and multilateralism that we're seeing, and I think that's the direction that the U.S. is moving toward.
So the rebalance policy.
Right.
I mean, it's a major part of this president's, President Obama's foreign policy, and he's the first Pacific president we've had. And that, you know, the United States has been in the Republic of Korea a lot longer, you know, for 60-plus years now, committed to its defense. But, yeah, Asia is more more important to us and more involved in Asia than ever before. And as Professor Yeo said, we are committed to the defense of the Republic of Korea, and we say that all the time, whenever our dignitaries visit, it's always something we never forget to say and reassure the Republic of Korea people. So I can say it again here, but I think it's pretty well known. And the North Korea threat still exists. And that's why, you know, that's the primary reason why we have this alliance, and it's why it's going to continue.
But one way to look at it, though, is, you know, because the question is, well, what about what's happening in Russia or in the Middle East? And we keep getting moved into different contingencies. And I, you know, I put it in the analogy of investments, because I'm now that I have kids, I have to think about these things. But the crisis, those are the fires that you have to put out. There are going to be crises that come up all the time. But if you look at Asia, it's more, I mean, we don't see any, there could be crisis potentials, but we don't see all-out wars taking place at the moment. But it's like a long-term bet, or it's a long-term investment. And I think interviewing many U.S. officials the past couple of years, I get the same story, that they are committed to this region, even if you have to put out these fires that are taking place in the Middle East. So you should think about it as more of a long-term investment for the future.
Bridging the question of the credibility of the U.S. commitment to the region and to South Korea specifically with Dr. Merrill's point about dealing with the challenges of an evolving alliance, I think one of the critical issues that the alliance needs to take on in coming years and decades is defining a post-North Korea logic for the alliance. For the last 60 years, we've been animated by the imperative of deterring and, if necessary, defeating North Korean aggression. And I think that is entirely appropriate and is what the alliance should be focused on principally. But whether collapse and potential reunification is in 5 years or in 40 years or who knows when, the alliance will have to deal with this issue of what you do after North Korea in its current state. And I think that drawing out that logic will go a long way to clarifying for South Korea the enduring security interests that the United States has with this alliance. And that will, I think, hopefully reinforce the assurance of the credibility of the U.S. commitment.
Thank you very much. I'd like us to move to the other question, which had to do with the ROK's relationship to the U.S. missile defense system, that architecture. Van, do you want to take a shot at it?
Yeah, I don't remember the question exactly, but I'll answer the question that I wish I had been asked. We talk about, the U.S. talks about a sort of regional missile defense architecture only sort of sparingly or inconsistently. There is a set of U.S. investments in missile defense, so radars, queuing systems, interceptors, and you have Japanese investments in missile defense. And over the last few years, you've had us working in co-development on missile defense. And then increasingly, Australia is becoming part of this as well. So there are some U.S. officials, especially in the missile defense milieu, who talk in terms of a regional architecture, but there isn't a... The regional architecture that exists today is patchwork. It's stitching together national capabilities. And so the fear of some sort of like region-wide architecture that constrains China or something is illusory. That's not real. And so what we're trying to get to is the ability to have, okay, everybody has their own national capability, call it what you want, but we need to be able to plug and play with each other. And so the effectiveness of missile defense increases not by sums, by multiple factors whenever you can add capability, when you get more angles from different radars and you have redundance. So missile defense is not a perfect science. It's actually like quite flawed, and we're just getting better over time. And so it's useful, it's valuable for everybody. It grows the pie to be able to participate and have high degrees of interoperability. We can call it regional architecture, or we can call it something else. Korea is trying to call it something else. But at the end of the day, it hurts the U.S. and Japan and to some degree Australia and even South Korea if it's not a part of a larger whole.
Go ahead. Personally, I think that the phrase regional missile defense architecture is overblown for a lot of the reasons that Van just mentioned. What's important is to have an effective system, and one of the key ingredients to that is the interoperability between U.S. systems and other capable systems as they come online, whether in Japan or South Korea. And I think oftentimes people overuse the word integration. To address the question about the various layers of missile defense and the various phases at which capabilities can address threats, putting aside specific systems like THAAD or others, I think the important thing to remember is that given intensifying North Korean missile threats, we need to be able to have an approach that can address threats from various types of missiles and missiles in various phases of flight. And the way to do that, based on all of the analyses of missile defense architectures, is to have a layered system comprised of various capabilities. And so whether that's THAAD or whether that is some indigenous Korean solution or whether it is sea-based intercept capability that Korea obtains, what is important to have an effective missile defense is to be able to address different types of missile threats at different phases of flight. And so I think that we can kind of get wrapped around the axle talking about an integrated missile defense or talking about THAAD and what Chinese perceptions of that are. And we need to keep returning back to what makes missile defense effective, and it's a lot of the things that Van highlighted.
Thank you very much. I'll take two more questions, and then we will break for lunch. One of our participants, Ji-young Song, all the way from Singapore. You want to stand and tell us who you are?
Ji-young Song from Singapore Management University. Since Dr. Jackson is talking about threat perception, let me take a slightly different approach to threat perception. I think you seem to take a defensive realist take on the threat perception, and I'll probably try the constructivist approach to this issue. This is where IR theory comes useful for this student of IR theory. We talk about the U.S. or South Korean perception of the North Korean threat. Let's just turn the table completely around from the other side. What would be the North Korean perception of threat? Is South Korea, Japan, China, or U.S.? Who's more threatening from the other end of this spectrum? Because threat perception is mutual, and if we want to have our own perception of North Korean threat, we need to think about which country North Korea would hit first. Would it be a weakest link in this alliance management? Would it be the strongest one?
Yes, the gentleman over here.
Hi, thanks. It's Mike Billington from EIR. I brought up a similar question in the first panel, but it wasn't addressed, and I think it needs to be addressed. You say that that the idea that there's a fear of encirclement of China is absurd. I don't think it's absurd at all. The U.S. is carrying out exercises for its air-sea battle. We're putting missile defense around China and Russia in Europe. And the South Koreans recognize this. They're not just concerned not to have bad relations with China. They perceive, and Park Geun-hye said this in her meeting with Xi Jinping, and in the meetings with Russia, which is that they perceive the Eurasian development, this idea of Eurasian development of the Russian Far East, of China, of North Korea, as their only hope for long-term peace in North Korea, not threats and sanctions and either you do what we say or else. They're concerned about nuclear weapons, of course, but they are, in fact, making joint development projects around Rajin. They're talking about building railroads through North Korea. These are development projects as a basis for peace rather than just this threat from an economically broken Europe-American system. I think they're looking at development for themselves and for all of Eurasia. Okay, and I think you have to address that.
I need to wrap up the question period so that we could just have, we're running 5 minutes late, but that's okay. We'll give 5 minutes to our roundtable folks to offer some thoughts in return. So two questions on the table regarding the constructivist IR theory, the constructivist view of the truly constructing threats and the perception of threats, in this case, North Korea's perception vis-a-vis the other powers, and then this question from the gentleman. Any takers here?
I would just point out that I studied under Andrew, who is steeped in critical theory and constructive social constructivism, and I don't wear labels, but to the extent that I do, I would actually say I take a constructivist approach to IR. The challenge is that there are limits and there are sort of different logics that prevail at different times. And the logic that seems to prevail with North Korea, regardless of the approach that we take, is it fits a defensive realist frame, I think. The question is fair, though. You know, what would North Korea do based on its threat perception? And I don't have an answer. But it's not obvious that it would be based on its identity. A military attack is usually based on something. Identity forms a context for a military action, but the decision is motivated by something a little more proximate.
You could discuss it at lunch. Anyone on the second question?
Well, I can kind of build on what Van said, or just bring it down to a simple point. I mean, when North Korea is developing and upgrading, improving its military capabilities, the alliance can't sit still. It has to adapt to that, and it has to make sure that it has what's necessary to deter those capabilities. So, yeah, obviously trust becomes a big issue between both sides, and that's definitely not solved, I guess, when both countries improve their military capabilities. But the United States and the ROK cannot sit still as an alliance when the DPRK is becoming increasingly a nuclear state.
I think unlike the first panel, which had the luxury of critiquing the critiques and critiquing the policies and critiquing the critiques of the policies, our panel has had a tougher job because we actually have to think about specific answers to specific problems to which we can't possibly have all the answers. That's part of the problem. So we will continue these discussions, discussions throughout the conference. You're welcome to do so at lunchtime. And what I ask is that members of the audience, you are welcome to partake in lunch right outside on the other side here of the wall. And the participants, the official participants of the conference, we are going to go to a different room. We'll be led by Paul and some others. And we must return here by 1:10 because Ambassador Han Sung-joo will be giving his keynote at that time. Oh, I'm sorry. We will be having we'll be starting the next panel, the roundtable, and keynote and remarks, and that is a whole package that goes together on division and reconciliation in other lands and in the Koreas. Thank you very much.